to Rule 120, Rule 130 of the National Assembly. I would like to have nomination, please. Ma'am, Pam Mokwanya.
Honorable Member Ngadan.
Thank you, ma'am, for your nomination. Any objection? On seconder?
I second.
Okay. Are there any objections? Okay, thank you. In the absence of objections, I would like to announce and declare Mr. Richard Mtakane as our acting chairperson of the day, and then I'll give all the power to him to lead this committee. Thank you.
Pleasure. You move. Well, I want to tell you that I don't want to go. Okay, thank you very much, and let us then proceed with our meeting. I think because there are a lot of new members, but also I'm aware that it is a new Director General of Human Settlement, Mr. Thabane Zulu. I think they are going to introduce themselves. Started pressure. Or honorable Mashoba before. Into our band to Mashoba.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Into our band to Mashoba. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Butch Stein.
Tolerate a member of the committee, a member of the parliament, and replacing Babu Utamin, the senior, or say, the Houghton. You're welcome, Babu Sto. Committee, get a seven that I share a cool. But I have to file what I'm going to say to the world. Most welcome. Yes, well, McLua.
My name is Chao Mugliwa, member of this committee.
Hello.
Gloria Portman, member of the committee.
I'm Gomezo.
My name is Martin Mapisa from the Department of Human Settlement.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Thabane Zulu from Human Settlement.
No. Director General Zosuma was a sick born in that. It's not too much in our pool.
My pleasure, Chair.
You can rise.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Philip Chow. Chief Director of the Department of Human Settlement.
Morning, Chairperson, members. My name is Neville Kenny from the Department of Human Settlement, Chief Operations Officer.
Good morning, Chair, members. I'm Martin K. Bonasela. I'm a commissioner in the Public Service Commission.
Thank you.
Morning, Chair. Honorable members, Charmaine Julie, Regional Director of the Public Service Commission in the Western Cape.
Morning, Chair. Honorable members, my name is Indra Nadu, Deputy Director General of Public Service Commission.
Thank you.
Good morning, members. My name is Rosie Chiwagwaza. I'm the Parliamentary Office of the Public Service Commission.
Mind you, Robin.
Njobe. My concerns are Njobe.
Name is Batista Bam Che. Batista Bam Mugwanya. I'm an honorable member and a member of the Human Settlement Committee.
Thank you.
Morning. I'm the AC Mashishi, member of the committee.
Good morning, I'm Hoka Sebone.
Madam Kitchen.
Thank you, Chair and members, honorable members. My name is Ralph Nkichima. I'm the chairperson of the Public Service Commission. Thank you.
Okay. Kodisana, one introduces you. And another member or staff are not introduced themselves. Also, there's a team next to me here. I think we can come and introduce ourselves.
My name is Temba Mthethwa from Group 5 and Everite.
Oh,
and
Everite.
And there's a few other ends as well.
Okay, and Honorable Chair, my name is Dan Anketel from Group 5 and Everite.
Oh,
okay. Mr. Abrams, PNG.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
Okay, my name is Jürgen Stregier, also from Group 5 and Everite.
Okay. No, thank you very much for the introduction. I think it's very useful for us because there are new members who have joined us, and also there's a new head of department or director general of human settlement. We thought that we should introduce ourselves for the purposes of knowing who's here, and we know now there's Group 5 and Everite. I think there are a lot of other groups that are coming. And honorable member, we should then start with our meeting and the most welcome. And, this is the meeting of the Human Settlement Portfolio Committee. Just to say that we have visited many parts of our country as part of the Coordinated Oversight Committee of the Parliament. That committee was established in terms of the rules of the House to visit all provinces and also to try to understand why there are so many protests in some of our townships. Our visit really has assisted us to understand the problem. Generally, members of parliament are relatively well informed about the challenges on the ground. And then when the staff comes, or the director, general comes, or chief director comes, they must just be aware that the members of parliament have visited many parts of our country, then they are well informed about what is happening to our country. We always request the director general that when staff and officials in our department appear before the committee, they should just always do two things. Is to answer every question with due respect and diligence. Because these are members of parliament who are elected to take care of the needs of our people. Therefore, we always appreciate that when staff comes in, even when we turn you back because we think you are not well prepared, just bear in mind, anyway, that we're not here for the sake of being here. We represent almost 48 million South Africans. I think it's about 52 million South Africans. Therefore, we think that is very important every time when we appear before us. And I'm saying this thing because of us. We have the new director general, that sometimes when your staff comes back to your office and complain that members were not very kind to them, you must just understand that you are doing our work. But also we are informed independently about what is happening on the ground. Because we visit this community, we talk to them, we do our type function. We always then appreciate really that working relationship should be understood in that context, that you are doing oversight function, you are implementing as a department. And therefore there will always be healthy tension between those who oversee and those who are implementing. These healthy tensions, we can't get rid of them. They're natural for us who are working together in this system. They're not personalized for any reason. And therefore, the department must just understand that and assist us to do some of this matter. It's very important because we're also preparing to give input into other structures of organization as we prepare for other meetings. Therefore, I think the department must always assist us to give us accurate information at the time here in order for us to inform the ministries and also to assist us to address some of the challenges on the ground. What we have just observed and the general point that I'm raising, that in many parts of our country, one major issue that has been raised by many people who are protesting on our streets is around the human settlement, broadly speaking. Lease and then housing and some services here and there, but general housing, in a narrower sense, is raised by many members of our communities. And we are aware that a large number of houses that we built, I think the minister was busy demolishing them, especially because of the poor workmanship. I think Group 5 is here also, will assist us to address some of these matters. We hope that we'll be able then to work, Mr. Zulu, and with these members of parliament who are very robust, and I guess also they will take their work very seriously, just to ensure that there's a very good working relationship, there are very healthy tension between us and the department. This is what we are going to do. And therefore, there will nothing will be personalized. It's just because of the work that we are doing. We are implementing, and then we are making laws. And then when you implement our laws, we must be sure that we are implementing the laws as we have passed them in the National Assembly. And then that's what we, I think, we should be doing. And then welcome to you. And I think also we are happy to some Kichima are here. Will also assist us to indicate some of the challenges that we are facing on the cloud. It seems the human settlement, broadly speaking, of course, is not a new concept. I think we have been discussing this matter for some time. But as a department, I think there are a lot of work that we're supposed to do. And we hope then we'll be able then, the Director General and your team, and also Dr. Mkijima, where you are located, just to assist us to ensure that we drive the process and the program of transformation in our country around some of these issues. And then, as I said, that we have seen many things as we visit our provinces. And then we are convinced that we are not wrong in some of the matters that we have raised before. And I think we'll be able then to engage with you with respect, of course, really, because there's no gain for us to fight with you at all. And then, but other areas we may not agree with you completely, they must understand that. That's how I think officials of officials in government must just take that view, generally. And of course, and I hope that what the president was saying, that some of our officials are the worst laziest people. It is not going to happen like that. Good, I'm teaching. You will assist us to address some of those problems. But I think the president was much more upfront on this matter. And therefore, I think we must work and must ensure that things are done correctly. That's what I wanted, just to prefix what we are going to give a report and trying to understand what we are trying to do. And we do have an agenda, honorable members, and I think there are 5 items on our agenda. The first will be briefing by the Public Service Commission on the Monitoring Evaluation Report for the Department of Human Settlements. Fourthly would be the briefing by Group 5 on Technology and Innovation. And then will be briefing by Department of Human Settlement on issue and targeting. And then these are issues that we have to look at. Them. Can we move for adoption of the agenda? To Aban, to Mashova.
I propose the adoption of the agenda.
Stay.
Second,
we have submitted the apology of Madam Tambuzo. She's writing her exams, and then if I agree with her yet that she must go and write her exams, and we should proceed then and deal with apologies, if any. Okay. Can we then move to the Public Service Commission? Dr. Mkijima and your team, please take us through.
Thank you very much, Chair, Honorable Chair. We in the Public Service Commission would really like to thank your committee for giving us this opportunity to interact on this important matter. The Public Service Commission's mandate, of course, is much wider than the subject of today. But basically, as you would know, Chairperson, is really to strengthen the oversight function of Parliament, as you have indicated earlier. Now, previously, the Public Service Commission, in the work that it does, will produce a number of reports. We investigate a number of areas, and we are confined basically to the public service. Previously, we have interacted with legislatures in the provinces. I think that's where the chair would know the work of the Public Service Commission from. Previously, we've had committees that we interact with in the legislatures in the provinces. Here at the National Assembly, we interact with the Portfolio Committee for Public Service and Administration almost on a daily basis. But recently, we have decided that we should interact indeed with most committees in the National Assembly and in the legislature, because the subject matter of the public service really concerns, if not all, most of the committees at the National Assembly. So it is in that light that we bring to you this aspect. I say this because I think, Chair, that it would be important that we continue to interact not only on the subject of today, but on a number of areas. As I indicated earlier, we work in a wide variety of areas, and we would be prepared to come to you at a short notice to give you a briefing, including the role of the Commission. Now, today I have a team here who have introduced themselves, and Commissioner Malasela, in particular, is in charge of the area that we're dealing with today, which is monitoring and evaluation. The person who will be doing the actual presentation will be our Deputy Director General, Mr. Naidu, who is the Deputy Director General in our office for monitoring and evaluation. So I will hand over to them. Commissioner Malasela may want to say something, but Mr. Naidu may take us through the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chair,
we'll
just leave it to the DDG to do the presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members, good morning to you. The purpose of this 20-minute presentation is to provide a high-level summary of an 80-page report that we have produced on the Human Settlements Department, a report which has already been engaged with the department. You will note it was presented on the 25th of January to them. Comments were received, comments were considered and incorporated. The attendance list of the persons who participated in that event is attached to the report, together with a list of recommendations and other evidence here. So we are now presenting this report to the Portfolio Committee, noting that we've given the department 6 months in which to implement the set of recommendations that is attached, and recommendations that have been presented to the department already. In the case of this department, it's a second assessment. We were last today in the 2001-2 period, and now the 9-10 period. So it's a similar instrument which actually shows progress over the 10-year period. The three broad thrusts that I will talk to, the background purpose, presentation of findings, and way forward. But in terms of the background, to note that what the system does, it does not look at everything. Chairperson, you mentioned what happens on the ground. We consider part of that, but not adequately, and hence not totally contained in this report. There's other work that we do, like inspections, announced, unannounced, service delivery, basket header surveys, which considers those inspections. And sometimes that may be in contradiction with what we find in this system. But South Africa is fortunate in that we have a 9-point good governance definition, which is in our constitution. And what we did 10 years ago is we unpacked the elements into an M&E system, which we've been implementing for the last decade, and has produced reports on 130 departments across the country. In the last cycle, we focused on housing, so you will receive a consolidated report very shortly on housing, which is all the departments of housing in the country which we've dealt with. We are just finalizing that. But apart from the consolidated report, what way will assist you and the committee is to compare the performance of the different departments as it relates to housing. So this system looks at the extent to which each department, and this department in particular, has complied with these principles, which we call the definition of good governance. This is of critical importance. We've come up with a rating scale and where people do not want to be is in the red area, which is no performance against all of the standards, or poor performance in most of the standards. And the system is evidence-based. Depending on what is supplied to us, in a scientific and rigorous way, we score. And the system is not secret. It's on our website. Everyone knows what the questions are. And we tweak the system also to cater for housing, which was a specific area. Most departments in the country actually score in the blue zone, which is adequate performance in several of the standards, which is 41 to 60%. So something like 70% of our departments would fall in that zone. And of course, we have excellent performance in the two upper bands. Just as a preamble to note that the Human Settlements Department has scored extremely well. It is their second assessment and they've fallen in the green zone. So at a 73% compliance rate was good performance in most of the standards. It actually indicates good administrative governance. But I say that noting that it is a system that that focuses. This table really compares the evidence over the last time we went there was 10 years ago. A same system. And in the 2001-2 cycle, the score for professional ethics, for example, was 20%, same indicators, which improved to 75% in the next cycle. Efficiency, effectiveness, and economy was 80%, slight decline to 70%. Development, audience, and public administration was 80%, moved up to 100%. Impartiality and fairness we did not rate because of the nature of the department, which was policy-oriented, although it can be in the basic point. Public participation in policy-making remained at 80% in both cycles. As far as accountability goes, it moved from 60% to 90%, transparency 40% to 100%, HR management 80% to 60%, representativity 60% down to 40%. And overall, you'd find that in the first rating, it was 58%, and in the second rating, 76%. So this department managed to move up a band, from band 3 to band 4, which is commendable. We made recommendations in 2001 and 2, and we dusted that off and went back to the department to see to what extent they have implemented it. And overall, the implementation was 72%, with 28% not being implemented. And we wish to suggest that the reason the department score has improved by a band, which is quite significant given how rigorous the system is that they have taken MNE seriously and has implemented the recommendations. So something needs to be said of that. So there is a functional MNE where they're able to quantify and track performance. Just also to note, Chairperson and honorable members, that we are presenting these reports time 30 across the country. So we are talking about a department here that is in our top cohort as far as the governance aspect goes. In this cycle, we made 10 recommendations, all of which the department knows about, and which is contained in the back of this annexure. We will present a separate report to yourself on how well they've implemented it. We give them 6 months. And recommendations were made in the various principles which are contained at the back office in a very clear recommendation tracker. I will now move to the 9 principles, 5 each, and once again to apologize, it's 15 pages compared to 1, but I think you get the point. What is important is the green arrow at the end. We measure professional ethics in terms of how long it takes to deal with a case of misconduct, because our argument, as indicated, if a department acts on misconduct, it clearly sends a message that unethical behavior will not be tolerated. And we are evolving the system and looking at more elements. So we moved from 20 to 70 to 75%, and that is a significant jump. It took the department on average 36 working days to finalize a case of misconduct. So what we do, we look at all the cases of misconduct and we start measuring, we count how long it takes. Because we try to look at, to prevent a situation where a case of misconduct remains and someone is suspended on full pay for 3 or 4 years, which creates a totally negative impression of the public sector. Training and capacity building provided by the department does cover the process of handling cases from the allegation to area of good practice. And also we found that there was quarterly reports provided to management on the status of misconduct. However, there was no evidence of management response or actions emanating from the response. It's an area of improvement. It does not mean there was no action. It means there was no evidence. The system is evidence-based, and we make a recommendation in that regard. The next principle, efficiency, economy, and effectiveness, we look at different elements here. The first element we look at is budget. Now, NATO says we provide the 2% waiver, either up or down. And this department was 4.4% under expenditure in 2007-08 financial year, for some of the principals will use slightly dated information, which we're working on. It's an area of improvement, because if the capital budget doesn't move, it is indicated. But it's still, it does move from 8% to 70%, which is the overall thing. What is significant is that 97% of the performance indicators were measurable in terms of either quantity or time dimension. This would come from the strategic plan, which, as I know, the portfolio committees are involved in. This is what the department says it's going to do. We go back and see whether they've done it. And we go through a rigorous process. All the indicators are back in the table here. And that's significant. And it was able to achieve 76% of its 262 planned output, or 76% on that overall 200. So that is contained here. Something that we say could be an area of improvement. So when we talk about efficiency, economy, and effectiveness, efficiency is how well the budget has been expended and how, to what extent, what's been stated has been realized in practice. It's an area that most departments fail because they put in lots of promises and they don't meet. And when it comes to the annual report, they choose not to report on it. So that is an issue. The third area, development-oriented public service, linking to the issue on the developmental state, and what we are arguing here, to what extent do the policies of the department contribute to the overall macroeconomic and socioeconomic development of the country? Performance moved to 100%. The National Housing Code provides for the participation of beneficiaries in the design and implementation of housing projects. The multi-year housing development plan guides provincial housing departments to fulfill the legal requirements of preparing a multi-year housing development plan, which outlines all the issues that must be addressed in the provincial plan. It is an area of good practice. So there's very explicit and clear policy and documents which help, and of course sometimes there may be attention in terms of how it cascades. The National Housing Code provides for the development of housing chapters of the IDPs to ensure that the needs are well assessed. There's identification, serving, and prioritization of informal settlements are included in each IDP. It's an area of good practice. And the department does have a system in place to identify lessons learned for application to future projects. One of the outputs of M&E Chairperson and honorable members is that all this information should lead to learning and better practice. So when we interrogated the department, we looked at the various forums in which sometimes the bad stories are told, so people don't repeat it. And that was one thing that's because oftentimes the bad stories are not put on the table because it's embarrassing. But when it's put on the table, it actually improves. And it's a clear output of M&E, but it also reflects the department has a functional effect in M&E. As far as impartiality and fairness goes, because the nature of the department, the national department performs, does not provide services directly to citizens, we did not apply this principle in this department, although in the 2001 and 2, we gave it a 40%, and we had some debate on the issue. However, Chairperson, honorable members, when you look at the provincial housing department, you will find we've assessed this principle. So there we can comment on the extent to which this principle actually applies. And that is also contained in the consolidated report. So I think you'll find the info there, as you have pointed out in your introductory comment, not that favorable. In terms of public participation in policy making, it remained at a high level. It always does not have an approved policy guideline on public participation in policy making. We found that it does go about involving the public in policy making. And what needs to be tied up is to now formalize the policy. It has in place a system for soliciting public input, and here we're looking at the government-citizen interface. Does it work? How does it work? And evidence was provided that the department acknowledges and considers input received from the public. So in the 6 months that we lived in the department, we went through all this and interrogated to see whether it really happened. And of course, the participatory part in policy making is clear evidence and is indication that the policy of the department has evolved due to public participation, which is significant. We come now to accountability and the different elements that we look at. Risk management, fraud, investigation, and of course the most important part, the audit opinion. So our system mocks up the audit opinion and uses that and gives it a value and score. It went to 90%. The Auditor General issued the department with an unqualified audit opinion in the 7-8 financial year. This is significant given the fact that only less than 10% of South Africa's departments get an unqualified audit. However, the highlighted concerns regarding the governance of departments, which include the unavailability of information and senior managers. And the detail is contained in the report. It's an area that needs to be improved. It has a formal performance management system for all departmental programs in operation. It conducted a risk assessment exercise during the financial year, during which all activities and or applications were assessed to ensure that risk was averted. It had a fraud prevention plan in which 85% of the requirements as set by the PSC transversal system were met. And we have in the main report what our system is, what are the checks, what's the checklist. And fraud prevention is obviously extremely critical given the propensity for fraud around the housing issue. And it had sufficient staff members to investigate cases of fraud, and the strategies of the fraud prevention plan have been implemented. It's an area of good practice. As far as transparency goes, in essence, we look at the annual report, which is a report, a guideline of which is provided by National Treasury and the DPSA. And we go back and we interrogate the annual report looking at that guideline and score it. Because the annual report is a clear and key transparency mechanism. We found that the content covered in sufficient detail 90% of the areas prescribed by National Treasury and the Department of Public Service and Administration. And just to point out that the annual report is an M&E report, it's for public consumption. And what one expects is integrity and honesty in the reporting, and we found that in this case. Because that is what the public can then use to actually see whether the department did what it was supposed to do. Hence, the annual report now reads like an M&E document, you know, what's planned and what's really outcome. Performance against predetermined objectives is clearly communicated. The department does have capacity to deal with requests for access to information, since it had two appointed deputy information officers with duly delegated authority. And there is a manual on functions of an index of records held by the department and complies with the requirements of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And the whole question of PIA is very critical in transparency, because what we are trying to see is how open is the department, given the fact that it uses, is its operations fully open? We found that here. The last two principles relate to the people, the first one on how we manage them, and the second in terms of who we have. There was a decline from the first period to the second period, from 80 to 60%. We found a recruitment policy in place. However, it does not address critical issues such as nepotism or patronage in the decision-making process, and we make recommendations in that regard. We found that it takes the department an average of 39 weeks, or 274 days, to fill a vacant post, which is far beyond the 12 weeks by the PSC system. And there was an explanation provided by the department in terms of restructuring, etc., which led to that. And we have included verbatim what the department said on our side. But however, the department acknowledged it needs to fill post much faster in order to ensure that it has capacity. Management reporting on recruitment was done during the department's executive committee meeting, and there was evidence of management's response. The department has a workplace skills plan for the 8-9 and 9-10 financial year. These plans are based on a thorough skills needs analysis. This now leads to this indicates the capacity available in the department. What is the capacity, what are the weaknesses, and how is it going to be addressed? So that was tight. But the impact of such activities on service delivery was never assessed, and that is an area for improvement. That people are sent for training, skills, etc., but so what? Has the overall performance improved? It is a more complex area of evaluation, because we have a practice where officials constantly attend training, but we're not sure what is the output of the training and how does it add value. So we point clearly that the department needs to look at that, so we get value for money from the investment. And finally, in terms of representativity, it dropped from 60 to 40% with poor performance against most of the standards. Our measuring system is here. The representativity targets nationally 75%, blacks at senior management, 50% women at SMS, and 2% people with disabilities. The disabilities was exceeded at 2.7%. The women was 39%, or 11% below target, and the blacks at senior management was 82%, or 7% above targets. In other words, the department needs to ensure that it meets these targets. But it has implemented 64% of the diversity measures suggested by the PSC's M&E system. So there's a whole policy that we look at to what extent that has been done. We do not find documentary proof to the effect that management reporting on representativity is done. In other words, these are the targets and this is what has changed, in order to keep the eye on the ball. So collectively, Chairperson, honorable members, this is a snapshot of the high-level scores and findings, which is contained in the report, which we saw is being made available to everyone. We saw sure you'll find it useful. Just to point out that we've had good cooperation from the department in our assessment. We lived there for 6 months. We learned a lot about the department. But more importantly, the work that we've done in the provinces would be significant. Because when we assess the housing department there, our questions are addressed. And we're asking more fundamental questions about actual service delivery. And that will be made available to you for further discussion, which we are now concluding in 5 months. And this has now been tabled, has been agreed. The persons who participated are contained in here. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Naidu, for the presentation. Honorable members, then you can raise issues and the procedures. I know that you received the document this morning. And then I guess that if you receive a document in the morning, the attendance of brain waves is very high. Honorable Palmer.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for that very well put together presentation you've given us today. And I think it's very encouraging to see the level of scoring against the principles that have been laid out here. However, I want to just turn to what for me is one of the most critical areas in our department, and that is the human resource. We have a very big vision from the minister going forward 2030 now, and if our department is lacking in the vacancies, will be taking a long time over that, and we don't get the right people into the right job, that is going to be of great concern to us. So I would like to have perhaps a little bit more detail on that. I know we do have this report here. I was also quite interested to see that in the recommendations that you made, there was, I think in all of them, no response from the department. So obviously the department then were quite happy with all the recommendations that came out of that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. From my side, I would like to address the issue of soft skills. And I think one would agree with me that soft skills, when it comes to professional skills, it's very important. I just want to check why the time frame for 10 years and what is the reason for the hibernation. And also in terms of the results of this report, one would also assume or guess that there is anecdotal evidence for this. But my concern on the professional ethics is that how can we address the issue whereby the managers could not show any evidence emanating from the report? That is of very critical importance for me when this specific area has been assessed. I think we need explanation thereof. And I also would like to have more elaboration on representativity. When you look at the results, it really, you know, within 10 years, perhaps also the same concern, why 10 years? Perhaps within 10 years, there is a drop from 60 to 40%. Also want some more elaboration on that. Thank you.
Well, obviously.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me, I think, in my capacity as the spokesperson for the DA, welcome the new DG. I want to assure him of our support, conditional though, as long as he performs his responsibilities in an unbiased and efficient manner, he can be assured of our support. Welcome. Chair, I also want to thank the Commission for this report. And the very first question links to what my previous colleague said. I'm somewhat concerned that we've got this 10-year gap. And looking at the results, I noticed that some of the specific results refer to, for example, 07-08, and others refer to 08-09. So I'd like more clarity with you know, how was this evaluation done? Did they take a year in which something improved specifically and use that improvement for the rating, or was it sort of an average over the period, considering that the last one, the one prior to this, was done in 2001-02? Then, and I'm not sure if this is the right forum, perhaps I should engage with the Commission outside of this forum, but I'm interested in the process that is followed to do this assessment. Mention was made of words like scientific, etc. And you know, in terms of this, I think I also need to congratulate the department then, but I've said, in light of your remarks earlier that we've been a lot more on the ground recently, it doesn't, the good performance and improvement in the department doesn't seem to translate in similar action on the ground. So my question is really, is the assessment purely on paper, on policy? I think which we all know is very good, but it's the implementation. So I would assume that you're not looking at the implementation at all. Then, Chairperson, Principle 2, I mean, it talks specifically about efficiency, economy and effectiveness. I'm not sure if you can, if my assumption is correct, that you're not necessarily measuring what the implementation. I don't see how you can say that a department is efficient and economical if they've, according to the report, they've spent 96% of their budget. Because I think we all know what is on paper in terms of expenditure, and I hate to bring this up again, but it does happen, perhaps not as often as it did in the past, where the department, by and large, transfers money to provinces, and they in turn transfer some money to the municipalities, and we know that municipalities have complained about dumping. So the fact that on books it has shown that 96% of the budget has been spent, again, is not necessarily a good and particularly an efficient rating. One needs to determine how that money was spent. And that brings me to the other principle, which is, I think, transparency. And it talks about performance against predetermined objectives is clearly communicated. Now, I'd like to differ with the Commission on this, in this instance particularly, because the department has gone, and mention was made of the annual report, but the department has gone from where they previously reported in the annual report on the deliverables in terms of houses completed and or under construction. Now, that is, first of all, not transparent, because it doesn't make a distinction between how many houses was completed and how many is under construction, and they could be at various levels, from foundation to roof, etc. So it's not transparent. But the last report that I've seen, the annual report, it completely, since it's been raised in committee and elsewhere, it now completely ignores that particular part of the report. It doesn't tell us how many houses have been built or is under construction anymore. So I have a problem with the performance being measured against objectives, because there's clear objectives when the budgets are made that X number of houses will be provided, X number of sites, etc. But I don't get that synergy anymore between the budget and the annual report. Chair, I think that is all for now. Thank you.
Honorable Baum.
Thank you, Chair. The previous speaker has sort of addressed some of the things, some of the matters of concern. I wasn't sure when the presentation was being made whether it was relating to what we see on the ground, and because it does not seem to reverberate what we see, because what is evident on oversight is manifestations of non-transparency, manifestations of understanding and sometimes the professional ethics and, you know, a lot of things which have been catalogued here have shown themselves on the ground, but they don't seem to be reflected on the report itself, on the presentation itself. The presentation has been good for, you know, being a presentation, but for some reason it does not seem to evidence what we always come across when we do oversight. For instance, there are so many rapturous demonstrations that we see outside on you know, with housing, and there have been investigations that have been carried on, and those are the consequences of some of these maladies that seem to be highly scored here. And I'm not sure whether, you know, this is fine. Thank you.
Manjob and the Honorable Machova, that will allow them, the commissioners, to raise other issues. And then hopefully, anyway, we won't be able to exhaust every point in this meeting. Surely we'll need some time, even ourselves, to read the document and correlate it with our experience on the ground. That's very sure that the commissioners, I think, will always be available and are requested to come and appear before the committee. Manjola.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to understand better the question of the Principle 4, impartiality and fairness. I do understand when you say because of the nature of the function performed by the party. But then, what I wanted to find out was the department has done well on the whole. That is a success. But now, is there no link between the functioning of the department, the national department, and, for instance, the functioning of the province? In other words, I'm trying to find out whether, supposing the department does very well, the national department does very well, but the province don't. So how do we link that? In other words, what responsibility does the national department have over the province? I hope I'm
making myself clear.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is only maybe a few. It's a question of monitoring. Do the committee did give themselves a chance to go and see the project down there? Besides the paperwork, this one we're getting. Maybe the consultant may be good to develop this paper for you instead of you going down and see exactly what's going on there. The housing which the minister was forced to demolish because they were bad. At the same time, those contractors who have been paid up in advance, what is what is after telling them happening there? Because if the contractor has been paid up in advance, and if the quality of the work is not good, now the minister is forced to demolish that. And where do your monitoring? It was those maybe sometimes the consultant is good in writing these papers for you, especially if you don't go down. The reflection of these papers is not the same as what we know from on the ground. There's a vast difference, and also there is the Principle 5, public participation. What do you mean by that? Maybe you advertise on paper that somebody says, no, they must comment or this is the policy making. So that means the people are left to sit down and engage in each other. How is this public agreement is done? That's all.
Okay, thank you very much. Let us invite the commissioners and they will see who takes what, just to assist us and to answer some of the questions. Department is also here. I think we'll also be allowed some space to, when they do their presentation, also to take some of the issues that are raised or some of the questions are directed to the department. Yes.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think that your comment that some of the issues may not be completed today is quite appropriate. But let me just respond to the broader issues, and then I think Indran and Commissioner Malasena can also pick up on the gaps that will emerge. I think the first broad question is, what is being monitored and evaluated? And I think that is at the core to me of the question. I think that in the introduction we did say that we are really monitoring principles that are listed in the Constitution. And those principles are the principles that are listed here. Now, that evaluation is a challenge in itself, in that one must look and pick up indicators. Since we put in place this monitoring and evaluation system, we have reviewed the indicators. We have already now, next month, we'll be again re-evaluating the indicators and changing them as the need arises. So that is why we appreciate the input that is being made, which is implicit in the questions that are being asked, in that we take the comments on these questions, because for me, they are not only questions, but they are as well comments and concerns on certain areas of the department. So that, for us, is an indication on how to sharpen these indicators to bring up the issues that are being raised here. Now, the other pertinent question is the question of the 10-year gap. Now, the Public Service Commission would have liked to do everything. We would have liked to monitor and evaluate each department each year, even 6 monthly sometimes, it might be appropriate. But the problem of the Public Service Commission is resource constraints. So what we have done, we have had a system, and I think that Mr. Knight, you can talk to that a bit more later. But it's a question of resources. We stagger the monitoring and evaluation. We pick up on certain departments on a particular year and follow up, unfortunately, and in this instance of a human settlement, which was previously housing, it has taken 10 years to come around again to do the monitoring and evaluation. So that accounts for that 10-year gap. But as I say, it basically is a question of resources. Now, the question that comes up again and again in terms of, have you been to this service delivery site as the commission, for scoring purposes? Why is it that we have these protests on service delivery when the department is purported to be good? Is there a link between, I think it is a member, Manjoba, was saying, is there a link between the department, national department, and the provincial department? Yeah, no, the upfront, we would like to say the monitoring and evaluation system is not comprehensive. And again, we would have liked, as we have done in some departments, we have conducted inspections in the clinics. We've just finished that in the health department. We have conducted inspections in the South African Police Services 2 years ago. So in this particular instance, this is a system that we're applying. We haven't gotten involved in other methods of assessment, like I've said, inspections where we actually interrogate and interview people on the ground. Now, the report on a human settlement is now focusing this one on the national department. As was indicated by Mr. Naidu, there are provincial reports which are there in the consolidated report. I think he did refer to the one on fairness in particular, to say that because this department is not interacting with the public, that has been focused on the provincial department. So that can emerge there. So the committee is rightfully asking the question, well, how, to what extent is this department responsible for that? And the answer to that would be yes and no, depending on the legal framework, as you know, because we've got accounting officers at a provincial level. We've got an accounting officer on his own right at the national department. So the answer to that is yes and no. And I think the challenge for the committee and ourselves is to say, how do we tease out those aspects in order for us to tighten our M&E and put what is the responsibility of the National Accounting Officer and the Minister in the right place. So for me, that really is a challenge. The other question is the question of public participation. What does public participation mean? I think our constitution and our legal framework is very clear about the role of the public in terms of delivery of services. And more important for me, actually, is even in the policy formulation. Very little in our public service is being done in terms of public participation. I know that at a political level, representatives, I think we've got the most dynamic democracy in South Africa, and it's great. But when you unpeg the public service, it is almost silent on public participation. I can't, for the life of me, imagine why the public service is not training people in an area that is so crucial. Because in order for public servants to be conversant, they actually need the skills to be able to make people participate in the policy formulation. When the departments are formulating their policies, they don't call the public to come and participate. They rather prescribe what policies might be good for the government. At a broad level, of course, you know, that happens at a political level. We have, you know, very good policies. We've got, for instance, in the health department, we've got the 10-point plan, which is excellent. But when we actually try and do take a level lower in policy formulation in terms of saying how do we now deliver the houses, people don't participate. Public servants I've spoken to don't know where to start in order to ensure that they take the public along. In the Public Service Commission, we have evolved a process of a citizens forum, which we have piloted in Mpumalanga and Eastern Cape, where we have actually workshopped with the communities. We chose health, we chose social development in another setting, where we actually call the department together with the people that are served by the clinics and the hospitals, and we sit down and they raise their complaints, they raise their concerns in the department. And when you listen to these, they strike at the core of the policies that have been implemented. And on those two instances, we did take down the concerns of the people together with the department, put it to the department for the department to say what it could implement, what it could not. We jotted that down together with the department. And on another occasion, we went back for the same workshop to give the public, the community, what the results of that exercise has been. I know that the invisible happens at a broad level, but at a micro level of a department like health and the clinics, for us that was a big lesson. And we have reports, we have a toolkit now, which we are rolling out to the department for them to be able to implement that. So the constitution takes the question of public participation very, very seriously. We do also in the Public Service Commission. There is a lot that needs to be done that is not being done. I don't want to take most of the time there, Honorable Chair, but I'm sure I've left many gaps. Commissioner Alasela, Mr. Naidu, any?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'll also try not to rehash quite a number of aspects that we have already spoken to. The questions posed by honorable members are not necessarily unfair. They are correct and fair. Exactly because I've been a politician myself, I know what honorable members would want to see the department doing. and is correct, then say if there's no relationship between the report itself and what we should have now, something must be explained. When Intern Nandu was presenting, he indicated this, that the system is evidence-based. It's based on the evidence that we get from the department. And I would appreciate that when you have time, honorable members, go through this report. This report would give you, in essence, what the system of MNE by the PSC Commission is all about. What is an indicator on principle number one? What are the standards going down up until you take all the 9 principles? So this is the standard that we piloted and the intercity department is about, and we came to them and say this is the standard we're going to monitor. Department about. It's evidence-based. If departments want to lie to us by word of mouth, we also want to get the evidence, the correlation between what they say and what is in the department. Yet, we do not then say as part of this toolkit, after we monitor and assess, we also go out and look at the houses that have been built. That's what the chairman is doing. And then that is why I'm saying it's fair for you to then say the houses that we see demolished, there's no relationship between important and then what we see outside. But in the Public Service Commission as well, we have what we call the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. And in that hotline, in relation to departments, the department wherein complaints are reported about is the Department of Human Services. So that is why when the chair opened, he said, "Would appreciate to have more time with yourself." So that would come back to you and say, these are the complaints that relate to the building of houses in the human settlement department. How has the DG responded to this complaint? And you then realize that the complaints that have been reported to us correlate, therefore, with that which you are saying you have been able to observe as you go out. That is the difference then between this system and other systems that you are able to have in the Public Service Commission. So that system itself speaks to your point. That houses are being demolished. Everybody, people are complaining. Councillors are selling houses, people are selling houses and so on and so forth, and they all inspect on the department. That's one point I wanted to indicate. Honorable Mashoba, this report is not consultant driven. Okay. This report was prepared by the Public Service Commission. When Indra and I do presented, he said, we have assessors who go to the department. Our assessors spend, 6 months in the Department of Human Settlement, sitting there, looking for each and every evidence that relates to the principle. So it's not necessarily consultant driven. That is what we are presenting here today. It is our report, so you must have confidence on the report itself. And we appreciate here and there that there will be differences between our points as relayed to the commission, as relayed by the commission, and what honorable members are saying, but we have generally said, there's a correlation, or there's no correlation between the toolkit itself and what you see as you do your oversight. Because we don't necessarily, with this toolkit, do oversight in assisting departments. Lastly, Chair, there's a point that I picked that I want to respond to before Indrian speaks to. Okay. The aspect on provinces as well. Chairperson, we're meeting each and every MEC and each and every portfolio committee in the Republic on human settlement. Because with MNE, we have monitored and evaluated. So we'd also appreciate that we be called back to come and present to you the consolidated reports of all the departments of human settlement in the county. So that the questions that you are raising as well, as you take this report and take the consolidated report, you'll then be able to sit and say, with regard to what is taking place in provinces and with regard to what is taking place in the national context, what therefore are the gaps, what are therefore the correlations, and how do we as a committee begin to do oversight work to short circuit some of the gaps? Yes, I think the chairperson has answered quite eloquently the point on public participation. I would not necessarily rehearse that, but just to give you an example, as we're meeting with the MEC of local government and human settlement in Limpopo, he'll tell you how his department has been transformed to a situation where people participate in policy making. As and when he goes out to the village, he has a person who records whatever that is being said If Mantlobe says that there's a corruption in the department, she can be able to talk about that in her content. He goes there and look at what is the problem in the department, comes back to Mantlobe and say, Mantlobe, with regard to the point that you raised on this time, in this date, this is what we've been able to do. That is what we refer to as people-centered policy making. Not a consultant-driven policy making when we would have consultants in the department or other chairpersons prescribing to people how policy should be done. Those are a few emphasis points that chairperson I wanted to make in relation to the questions raised by honorable members. Thank you.
Thanks, chairperson. I'll just respond to three questions for the things they've been covered. The first, there is a difference when one is looking at a national department and provincial department. And when you, when we get an opportunity to present all the pile of provincial departments, you'll see the scores at the bottom. It'll be very, very different. But you'll also see in those reports more tangible evidence of what happens on the ground. And I refer you to this report to page 113. And you'll see the specific questions that we ask of housing, which is about the quality of housing, the discourse, etc. And it's quite a different picture. So a policy department which has things in place and the legal framework we've spoken about does give it the edge. But there is that disjuncture we have between national and provincial, but it's locked in other factors. The second point was the tenure gap. It has been spoken about. It's an issue of resources, and ideally we should go more frequently. But as we move forward, we would like to have shorter interventions more frequently with departments so that we monitor what is going on. The question was asked about the recommendations. Yes, the department will agree with the recommendations put on the table. But the reason they have not implemented it is they're in the process of it. So in the 6-month period when we go back and we'll present a report to you on what percentage of uptake of recommendations is, it'll indicate what they have done. Because some of them are policy issues and more complex, and we give them an opportunity for that. In terms of the question on representativity, the drop-in score, if you look at the scoring system here, for meeting different targets, a different value is given. So meeting a target of disability would be 1 out of 1, a full score. Gender, not target, not net, 0 out of 1. Representativity, black management, 75. The target is not met again. Because as much as you have underrepresentativity, you can have overrepresentativity. And in terms of the policy that comes out. So when these elements are put together, that is how the scoring happens. In the main report, the scoring system is quite clearly indicated. Also, in terms of evidence base, we have in this report the names of people we spoke to, who were interviewed, the sources that we consulted in the department, and also the PFE has put other resources, other information on the principles to take it forward. But I think what would be very insightful would be the provincial report. This is a score that is in a higher band of the national department. Less than 24 hours ago, we were presenting to another department where the score was 39% aggregate. And it was quite a different discussion, also a policy. And I think what would be important as we move forward, we would like to put all our reports on the website so that the country can see what is happening in all departments. And when you go into it, you really do get the story. For example, the nature of fraud. What were people found guilty of? What were they fired for? What was the nature of the offense? Without putting the names, we say where they went on the team. And it would be quite surprising how transparent. But thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. I guess that members, I think, will have more time when we invite them. We must also have time, just space and time for us to read the documentation. And then I guess that they will come back for us, Totem Kitchen, after World Cup. I think us will be very excited when we come back, having won the World Cup. They will assist us then to address some of the issues that we are raising. I think we should agree that they have made a presentation. We are going to work on the issues. And bearing in mind that Totem Kitchen, you are really responsible to enhance the capacity of the committee to do the effective oversight function over the department. In fact, we empower us as members of parliament to do effective discussions with the department. Our engagement with you should be almost regular engagement. And then because you are there anyway to assist us to do so. when we meet with Mr. Zulu, you must understand that members of the committee are the most informed ones, staying with the spokesperson for the DA on the housing matter. I'm not sure they had any issue to say. And I think we'll address that, and we should invite then their colleagues to allow other presenters to make presentation. And we'll deal with this one, we'll come back, I think we'll be after World Cup. We sit down, then we really work out some of the issues that will assist us too, as a committee, to address some of the challenges that are there. Because the human segment department is almost an anchor department for other departments that are working together with it to ensure that we deliver human segment really in the real sense, not just in terms of our deal. That's what we should do, man. Staying, I don't think we should really. But Lua, the meeting is closing this hour.
Thank you, and I just want to find out if we're going to meet again with PSC, possibility of also submit to us the organigram of the organization.
Yeah, I guess that's after the World Cup.
Yeah.
We'll come back.
I do have one question on this. If I just might, it's on principle 4 where the commission indicated that it's not applicable to the department. Now, looking at the more detailed report, I'm a little bit concerned that it says that the department, and it's specifically based on principle 4, did not always submit the required information. In the absence of information, the department's performance against principle 4, the indicator could not be assessed. Now that clearly is with respect to the commission, is a direct contradiction of the report. That it's not applicable to the department, when in fact the department neglected to provide the information. And it's, for me, it's quite serious, because it then starts to bring in, and I go back to the so-called evidence, and I mean we see it regularly, and it's no slight on the department either, but if it's a question of, let me provide you with information on which you're going to assess me, then naturally the instinct is to provide you with the good information, and not the bad. So once one has a perception like that, unfortunately, it can bring the very good results that the department seems to have obtained into doubt. Thank you, Chair.
I think because the question has got two elements. I think the one element is that of what actually happened when this information was being asked for. But at another level, it's also the nature of the indicator. The nature of this indicator, which is why I was saying we need to be reviewing them, how appropriate these indicators are. Because if the indicator that we have chosen on transparency, of which there can be many in this area of transparency, but the most comprehensive one that we came up with in this cycle of evaluations was the annual report, because therein is the transparency where people can see the work of the department and what it has achieved and not achieved. But we might as well have said, that we understand, but what we'd like now to see is whether, in fact, the response of a department to information that is being asked for by all the role players, say, that are attached to the department, including the public service commission, that a different picture may well emerge there, which is why I think Commissioner Malasela as well was saying that it's important to look and read the report in its entirety, and also in terms of the consolidated report to get a true picture. I think if you zoom in on one indicator, you may actually miss the intention. But as I was saying, some of the elements refer to actually what happened and how we reached at the conclusion. Inran?
But on page 57, if you go down, we have a further explanation that the department concluded that the assessment would be incorrect because of the nature of the performed. And on the basis of that, we then concur with the explanation that was provided. So whilst we indicate the department initially not failing to provide the necessary information, after the debate, we concur. And in other cases, you'll find that we have not concurred and gone ahead with what we believe is the right thing. So in the section on each part of the report, we have comments from the department. You'll find the comments we either concur or we disagree with. And in this case, we found it to be valid because of the nature of the request. However, in terms of the next year, we are going to be reviewing the system. And part of the review will involve getting input from persons like yourself on the ground. And we will then consider that in, so to tweak the indicators that they are more relevant.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and I think members have raised issues, and we are going to be engaging until, like, at the end of our term at Tottenham Kitchen. Therefore, I think we'll have some of these matters raised with you and see how we can take the information forward to assist us to do that. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think it was very useful, colleagues. At least that was a member of parliament, and I think we'll be able then to adjust it. Thank you very much for presentation. And what we will do then is to call upon the group five.
I wonder if we can discuss in the future. Can we be excused?
Okay. No. Commissioners, you are excused, really. If you want to greet us also, you are most welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
The one by the debate.
Oh, okay.
Let's forget.
So what are your new projects?
We're short of water. Yeah.
So what are your new projects?
We were so too
Oh, I remember you were saying that was last week. Okay, Mbabuban. Okay, Mbabuban. Yeah, it's less Dlamini now. Yeah, I'm the only Dlamini here. Which is good.
What?
Baba Macho. Le airport. You didn't sign up. Oh, I thought I'm the only one. Yeah.
No. I want to cross the F1. Let us invite a group 5 to make a presentation on the technologies and innovations. Group 5 and then 10.
Good morning, Honourable Chairman, Honourable Committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. It's rare that we get an opportunity to present represent what you do to such a high level committee. If you would not mind, as Senator stated earlier, the presentation that was emailed was very large. It was emailed in various segments, so I believe that some of the copies that may be floating around will not be complete and may be in the wrong order. So what I've done is I've circulated a couple of print copies and some CDs. What you will notice, and I do apologize, the presentations that I've handed out are going to be far more expansive. They will talk a lot more about all the technology that we deal with, whereas what I will show to you this morning is more relevant to what I believe the time available and what is relevant to you. So what you have in front of you will be a little bit more than what I present today. I would like to just speak a little bit about the Group 5 up front. In my capacity and in terms of capacity, we wear a number of hats within Group 5. Temba and I are both board members of Everight Building Products, which is better known for the manufacture of fiber cement products and related materials. We also represent or on the board of a new business unit within Group 5, which is called Advanced Building Technologies. And I myself am a board member of Group 5 Housing and Group 5 Motocom. And really why that's important is because it was just kindly raised to my attention again that Group 5 is not commonly known for being in the housing market. It's more well known for being, you know, the proud builders of the Moses Mabhida Stadium in Durban at the Durban Airport and some of the other big things that you may be familiar with. But we're not commonly known as house builders, and yet we do have a dedicated housing division. We do have a dedicated mass housing and affordable housing division in the form of Group 5 Motocar, and we also have a division which is specializing in alternative building technologies to feed into that market, and that's what I'd like to present to you today, which is alternative building technologies. It's a new division. It's only been around for about a year formally, although Group 5 Advanced Building Technologies has been around for about 5 years as part of Everight and part of Group 5 Housing. And what the division does is it's been exploring different technologies from around the world which are relevant to our country. Now, what I'd like to say up front is I'm sure that amongst all of you around the table today, I'm sure you've seen a number of different technologies. And I'm sure you've been presented by a lot of people who come to you with different technologies. And I'd be so frank as to say that the technology that I will present to you today will probably be technologies that you may be familiar with in one form or another. And I think the important issue over here is for me to say to you that I'm not presenting you something which is brand new, because we would not want to bring something into such an important market which is brand new. We've presented something to you that we as Group 5 are prepared to put our name behind, and that's the difference between what you see. If you had to go out in the country today, you would probably get presented with 300 different types of technologies. These are the technologies where Group 5 is prepared to put their name behind it, that we're prepared to commit to, and that we're prepared to follow up on for many years to come. And I think that's the important part of here, that it's not just the technology, there's a brand attached to technology, and there's an intent behind getting this off the ground. Just quickly, in terms of what I'd like to present, I will present to you some of the temporary housing that we've done. It may not necessarily be of the primary interest of this particular committee, but what we have found in the project that we have done has become a very big enabler of other projects. So there's many projects that the Department of Human Settlements in the Eastern Cape and in Kaiteng have done, which have only been possible as a result of the building of temporary houses. I'll talk about light vertical framing, which is our permanent housing technology, and then also some examples of commercial buildings that we have done. And again, it's important for you to understand that what we are doing and what we are presenting to you today is not dedicated to the Human Settlements Department. We have been doing these things for everybody, whether it be commercial, industrial, very high-end housing, mass housing. We have done a lot of work over there. The technologies are common. There's common themes amongst a lot of them. All right. Why is this important to you? I was listening with great interest this morning about some of the problems that you face, and the problems are too broad for us to provide solutions to, but other than to say that we are here to provide solutions for two problems which you encounter. The one is the rate at which buildings are built, for one, and those buildings, which is obviously a big issue and has received a lot of press in town recently. What we can do here is that we can, with our technologies, present to you anything from a temporary building up to some very, very substantial high-end buildings. In the flow of the presentation, you'll see start off with very basic structures and progressively move on to very high-end structures so that you can see that the technologies span a whole bunch of applications and are not geared towards a particular market. Roy said that if you can do a building in brick and mortar, you can do it in alternative building technologies. And I think it's something very difficult to get our minds around. As a country, we've been building with brick and mortar for many, many years. It's a standard form of technology, and it's not easily understood that there is a potential to convert. And we don't want to go and convert the whole world. That's not our intention. All we want to do is progressively start and select a few key projects in which we can present what we do. And in time to come, we will become like the Australians of the world, the North Americans of the world, the Europe of the world. We're anything between 30 and 60% of the houses built in those territories are built in technologies what we here consider alternative and what they there consider normal. All right. So really, what are we able to perform? We can build buildings at four times the pace. So for every 100 buildings that you would normally build, we'll build 400 buildings in the same period of time at a lower price. In the event of a mass housing opportunity, if the budget is fixed, we will build at a higher spec level to meet the predetermined pricing level. Much more superior thermal and acoustic properties, and this is gaining interest in the market now. With Tag 204, the new building regulations, which is due to come out in the next few years, the thermal performance of the buildings will be far more relevant. Okay. We can build on uneven terrains, which has traditionally been a challenge, in very remote locations, and I'll show you some photographs. Much lower material losses. If you speak to some of the bigger construction companies like the TKs of the world and a couple of other ones, they will tell you that they will lose up to 30% of the material on site. And this type of building technology goes a long way towards reducing those losses. Right. And the most important thing for me, and this is what I'm trying to present in this presentation, is that the quality is built in the factory. As much as there will always be a requirement to have a quality system on the construction site, the bulk of the quality is built in at a factory level, so it's a very controlled environment. And I think that's the issue that you deal with now, that you leave the quality in the hands of the people in the construction site, which is not always the best in this country while you face quality issues at the moment. Temporary housing. This presentation is in the form of pictures mostly, so I will be able to go through it fairly quickly. Just because of temporary housing, we manufacture our housing in panels. We can manufacture these panels in any number of different sizes, with doors, with various sizes of windows built into them, and we can essentially construct houses of a grand nature or a small nature based on being able to put panels together at your requirement. At the moment, what we deal with is with a standard which was a Kaohsiung-based standard of 24 square meters for a temporary house. This standard has recently been upgraded in the Eastern Cape to a 50 square meter house. And what we do is we manufacture the panels with high strength structural steel, polystyrene or polyurethane, and fiber cement panels. Everything that we talk about here is asbestos free, because that was a very big issue a number of years ago. And it's important that you know that everything here is asbestos free as well. Alright. As I said, it's a 24 square meter unit. It's fully demountable, it's got an engineer certificate, it has all the benefits of the products that we use in there, and we can build the house on a floor system, a steel frame floor system, not requiring a traditional foundation as well, which is also makes a big difference in terms of sometimes the cost involved or the access of raw materials into these particular sites. The house can be built extremely quickly. We've just recently secured an order, last week in fact, for 1,500 units in the Eastern Cape to be constructed in Teddy. We've done 500 units before in the Eastern Cape, in Alexandria, Teddy, in a number of different areas. Former housing minister has come to visit our site and has spoken highly of our site. We did a show house 2 weeks ago where we built a show house at the offices of the Eastern Cape Department of Human Settlement, and we built that show house in 4.5 hours. The entire house was built in 4.5 hours, and then promptly dismantled in 2.5 hours and put back into service. So the technology is well established and it's worked well for us. We've spent years developing it and we stand by it. This is essentially how we manufacture the house. The house gets built into pallets and gets transported to site. As you can see, the quality is high because the quality is all built from the factory level, and the panels go up fairly quickly with a reasonably small crew. The amount of people required to build this house in 4.5 hours is approximately 5 people. These are the first units that we built in Durakop, in Leperang, in Soweto. It's between Soweto and Indonesia. It's a big project that's currently underway, and this was the resettlement of people that were in informal houses on the site, and they were then relocated into a small settlement of about 40 units. Those units were very quickly built. I think this entire project took a week and a half, and bearing in mind that it was our first project, it went very, there was some learning to be done over here, but it still went fairly quickly. This is another example of Orlando West in Soweto. There's 155 houses over there, and this is a prime example of where temporary accommodation has facilitated a proper development of permanent houses. In the back over here, incidentally to your left, which is on the photograph, is Orlando Stadium. So it's right next to Orlando Stadium. The houses over there that you see with all the dome roofs are all in the region of 40 to 50 years old and all going undergoing refurbishment. So those houses were all being refurbished. The occupants of those houses were moved into the relocation village for a period of a couple of months while the units were being refurbished and then cycled back through. So those 155 houses in Orlando West are serving as a temporary accommodation camp for those people who've been temporarily moved out of their existing houses. That's again some examples over there. This picture may not be necessarily all that clear, but this is an example of the Eastern Cape. This is one of the 500 houses we built over there. These houses were all built for people who had lost their houses as a result of the extreme weather conditions in the Eastern Cape. So these people had their permanent houses, but were subsequently destroyed as a result of high winds or maximum storms which compressed the area. And this particular photograph made it to the newspaper over there because the person living in this house had been living there for 11 years. And the caption under the photograph was from a tractor pallet. And if you go to the house of pallets, it goes to show the spec level that was put in place. What's interesting about this photograph is you can see the entire house is built on uneven terrain. This house is also built in 4.5 hours on uneven terrain and put up very quickly. So the crew arrived in the morning, and by lunchtime, the house is occupied. And then, you can see the floor system which is sold with the house as well. We've then upgraded the application to a number of different units. And again, as I said to you earlier on, what you'll see from the flow of the presentation is that you'll progressively start seeing how we get from smaller to bigger structures and how the structures become more elaborate at a much higher spec level. So we did some classrooms in Mafeking. These classrooms were all built in a week. We've done some higher spec level classrooms. At Group 5, we also do a lot of donations, SED projects around the country. Our mandate from an SED point of view is that we are supporting 100% education, and by default, what we do is we've donated a large number of classrooms into various schools around the country using our panel technology. And here you'll see an example of a 48 square meter classroom, tiled floors, ceilings, electricity, everything you require that we did from the Zonka Jesuit School, which is around the corner from the Edwright Factory. Now, move on to permanent housing, which I think is more of your application. I think you'll get a sense now. The permanent housing is split up into two regions or two areas. The one area is the panel type, from what you've been familiar with here. And the panel type, you can, I would ask you not to mistake the panel type technology with a low end technology. The panel type technology can really be dressed up to become a very high end technology, and it gives you the benefit of cost, speed, and quality that you would get. So, this is a Shaw house. If any of you are in Johannesburg, please contact me and I will take you to a number of Shaw houses that we have. This is a small 50 square meter unit that we have. It's built in about 3 days. You can see the spec level is much higher. It's got proper floors, vinyl walls, ceilings,
in, it's got a bathroom and a shower in there. And that community, that's more designed as a unit for a project manager and construction site for clinics in rural areas, doctor's rooms, that type of thing. But the same technology equally applies to permanent and matching affordable housing as well. Okay. This one here, we built four units, 24 square meters, and we built units up to 1,000 square meters. And I'll show you 1,000 square meter structure towards the end of the presentation, and that's at Carter Airport, which is what we built over there. It comes, as I said, with electricity, comes with pollution, it comes with or without a steel frame floor system, and this is the type of technology that we are presenting to you to solve some of your housing delivery issues. At the moment, the entire structure is designed according to the rational design concept. Because, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, we've done such a vast number of different projects before, we've worked on the rational design process. We do have a 40 square meter solution at the moment, and that 40 square meter solution will come with the Agrimont certificate. So that it does solve that part of your requirements as well, which is currently in process. Alright. There's again some finishes of the structure. In this particular case, the structure was designed to be a site office or a doctor's room. Okay, and that's why it's designed. If you want more, bigger, smaller, all of that can be designed. And I think, again, just to reiterate the point, it's a very quick erection process with reasonably low skills and science. All the work that we've done in the Eastern Cape has been done with people from the local communities, and we've got some very good success stories over there. The one that I like to tell the most is one of the contractors there, the man that was retrenched from Cadbury 11 years ago, and he's now built his own construction company. He's got two vehicles, all as a result of erecting our temporary housing. Yeah, so there's some very nice success stories out there. All right, affordable housing, and lightweight steel framing. This is the next step up, and I'm sure many of you will see it. It's quite a popular way of building in the Western Cape. Also in KZN, it seems to gain traction. But just to give you an example of a couple of structures that we're busy with. And all these structures are internationally recognized technology. They've all got the SAB S approval, they've got an NBRC approval. It's approved by the banks, it's approved by the insurance companies. So all these things that are the questions that may come to you as you do this presentation. Very similar to the USA and the Australian way of building. As I said, what we consider advanced or alternative building technologies here are considered quite normal. If you want to build a brick and mortar house in the United States, that's considered alternative. Okay. We've intended to target the affordable housing market. This solution, in terms of the human settlement portfolio, really becomes effective from the 60 square meter mark. It's not something that is applicable to the lower, to the smaller sizes, because technology does not lend itself to as rapid erection as the same structure does. Okay, we can go three stories in terms of what we've done already, although we know that in Europe and in the United States we've built eight-story buildings, and I will give you an example of a multi-story. Four-story building accommodation block in the Middle East that is called the structure as well. Okay. Again, the big test for us is the knock test. You know, if you knock on the wall, does this sound solid? Does it sound like a proper house or not? These sound like proper houses. We've got a number of different install technologies, right from concrete to polyurethane, to a number of different install technologies, and further requirements. This is a show house that we have at our Group 5 offices in Woodmead. Again, it's an open show house for anybody to come and have a look at. This house in particular is an 88 square meter house. It is two bedrooms, two bathrooms, kitchen, dining room, lounge, concrete roof tiles, all the windows and doors and everything that you require. It feels and looks like a normal house with the exception that it's from a temperature point of view superior and from a noise point of view superior. It's built right next to the Granulis interchange, the Pretoria interchange in Johannesburg. This house was built in 5 weeks, but once we get rolling with the development, we'll be building these houses between 2.5 and 3 weeks, from start to finish. So that's the speed at which you're building houses. And this house is there on the Mia land. I don't know if you're familiar with the Mia land in the Waterfall City development in Johannesburg. This was developed 5,000 of these houses going up in that area, ranging from 70 square meters to 110 square meters. We built the double story equivalent of this in Lusaka, and we built that in 2 weeks. So, alright. This is another example just of the steel frame housing. This is a 100 square meter cottage that was built in Johannesburg. Just a different style of look and feel, but basically what we're saying is that depending on the requirements, the technology can be adapted to whatever finishes you want. And if you want to have a look at the inside of the house, you can tell that the house has a similar feel to any other house that you've ever seen. And again, these houses are built on a continuous basis using Group 5 technology and built by Group 5. So this is a well-established technology. It's taken us 45 years to get to the point that we are now. And then for the members around the table that that want to see some high-end housing, this is a house in the Valdam, also near Johannesburg. You can see the dam in the background of the dam. This is how the house was built. And just to give you some sense of comparative numbers, this house was built in a very high-end estate on the Valdam. It was built, it was built in brick and mortar. It would take between 9 and 10 months to build. This house took 14 weeks to build. Okay, so it was built in just on 3 months. All right. The house was originally tendered on a brick and mortar finish at 9,500 rand a square meter, extremely high finishes. It was eventually built at 6,500 rand a square meter. So you get a sense of how the technology is working and what it can do for you. That's obviously an example of the house in a steel frame state and the house when it was completed. You get a number of different finishes. In this particular case, they're chosen aluminium with natural stone cladding, etc. And just to give you an example of what the interior spec level is, that's what the house looks like on the inside. So you can imagine that this house was built in 14 weeks. That becomes a very impressive structure. And what we found is that there's quite a few developers out there who are very interested in the speed of delivery because of the rental component. Because if you consider how long the cash is tied up for during the building process, and in many cases people are paying multiple bonds and long-term financing during the build process, if you can shorten that build process to one-third or one-quarter of where it originally started, the value of that cash is enormous. An example of some multi-story housing. You talk about perhaps not PNG, but that type of scenario perhaps. This is a housing project where our material was used in the Middle East, in Oman. These are massive sites, and I'll show you another photograph now of how big the sites are. But I think from your own point of view, I think you can get a sense of the organization of the site. If you notice one thing about this site, and if you're a contractor, you'll notice how clean the site is, okay, which is a real difference in it talks to the organization and the quality levels that are expected on these building sites. There you can see the examples as well. The crane that is used to build the houses are actually built into the structure, and the crane is then dismantled afterwards. And over here, you can see how many structures are being built. All these structures here are being built into steel frame, and all the ones that you see in the background at the back of it are also being built into steel frame. So what you've got over here is an example of a four-story housing estate, which has been built using steel framing. Some commercial applications. This is some factories in some of the Group 5 factories in Johannesburg. We call offices and ends of workshops. Some of you may be familiar with this building. It's at the previous airport in KZN in Durban. The Avis building and the car rental building next to it, I think it's material, has been built in this technology. You would never have known that this building took possession of what was built, and the reason why it was built in this technology is because it's built right next to the road. You can see the exit road is over here, and what you're required to do is to build a building very quickly without disturbing the main road access. So we built within a meter of the road using this technology. If you don't believe me, then once it looks almost finished, you can see the steel frame structure goes up over there. The plumbing, the electrical goes all into that steel frame structure. We do the cladding, we do the blasting afterwards. So that structure looks, feels exactly like a house, and it's guaranteed to last 50 years. Okay? So it has the longevity, probably far more than some of the permanent houses out there tonight. Is that it? That's the building over there that unfortunately is no longer in use with Andrew Airport. But I will tell you that the new airport does include a version of our technology as well in terms of the parts, etc., etc. Again, if you are ever in KZN, this is Inland Getty College. This, as a matter of interest, this is the head office for the Inland Getty College. Downstairs is concrete, just these columns over here. And the only reason why those columns are made in concrete is because if you choose to drive your car into that column, at least the column will win. In this particular case, the rest of the structure entirely is built in steel framing. All the patios, all those columns over there are built in patio. That's so far the biggest building that's been done by us. It's a 2,000-story triple-story building. And incidentally, this building was built in 7 months at 2,100 rand a square meter. Okay. It is the benchmark of the KZN Department of Education of how a KZN education building should be built in terms of speed and cost. It's just another example. I know I'm going through this quickly, but I am weary of your time and that you do have to move on. But this is our latest project that we've just finished now, which is the Entata Airport. It's a very prominent, very important airport because it sees a lot of high-level people going through. The airport is probably, I think, 10 to 50 kilometers from former President Nelson Mandela's house. And Mr. Mandela flies into the airport fairly often. The rationale between this around this building was that the existing airport terminal building needs to be refurbished. And while that refurbishing program goes on, which is probably going to take a year, that there's at least an alternative building through which delegates could move through. And this was the intention of this building. What subsequently happened is that the building turned out quite well, and they have absolutely zero intention of ever breaking this building down. When we built the building, it's a 1,000 square meter building, we built it with three possible uses. It could either be dismantled and rebuilt as is, or in terms of two 500 square meter buildings or three 300 square meter buildings. And it could also be dismantled and then donated to the Department of Education and used to construct 15 classrooms. So the way that the construction has been done was that it could be reused in any format after the fact. Customer was Eastern Cape Department of Roads and Transport. It uses our panel technology, which I showed you a bit earlier on. It's 1,000 square meters, and we built it in 7 weeks and 3 days over Christmas. So we had lots of rain, we had lots of stoppages, but we still built the building very quickly. It's supposed to be up for 9 months. It's now going to be used as a permanent structure within the airport, which will then house the airport offices and also the car rental agency. Okay. We're currently also quoting on two more terminal buildings, so again, for the Eastern Cape. The layout is very square. It was designed to be square. It's got arrivals, departures, it's got security, it's got bathrooms, it's got lounges, it's got everything you need in a 1,000 square meter building. The site in the back over there, that's the existing airport. Sorry, has anybody been to Mkhwanazi recently? Since February. And tried to that? You will recognize the building on the left. The plane comes and lands on the apron. The apron is over here. And that's the terminal building over there. So what we've done is we would designed or required to put the structure in this area over here. 50 meters by 20 meters, 1,000 square meter building. We put the floor structure in like that. The floor structure over here is identical to the floor structure that we used in either the temporary or the permanent housing models as well. And you can see the wall panels come up over here. The wall panels are delivered on pallets in the background over there. In this particular case, we used aluminium windows again, and the structure went up fairly quickly. Fairly quickly. Again, you can see a sense of the size of the structure over here. You can see how the roof goes up. Everything goes up fairly quickly. Everything is steel framed. The roof is chromadec to match the existing roof. And what we did there is we started finishing internally. It's got drop-in lights. It's got down lights. It's got a very high-end finish. You can see the bathrooms are also nicely finished bathrooms. And that's what the building looked like 7 weeks later after we started. We started off with a bank piece of ground, and that's what it ended up there. The bathroom, that's the departures wall on the top left-hand side. The bathroom's over there. And that's the main corridor through the building with the car rental agencies on the left-hand side and departures on the right-hand side. And that's what the structure looked like. So, again, what we have here is a structure that will comfortably last 50 years.
It was built at probably 20% less than the cost of an equivalent structure in that particular of that size. It was built in 7 weeks and 3 days. So I challenge anybody to build another structure in that period of time that looks like this. And it will be there for the next 50 years at least. It comes with air conditioning and everything required. Built in data points, electricity plumbing, etc. So, really, I know I've spoken quickly. It's nice for you to present some pictures because that means the most. I'd like to say to you that we have, at our fingertips, as Group 5, a large, respectable company with 12 billion rand with a turnover last year. We have a dedicated housing division, we have a dedicated technology division. We've got the capacity in the factory right now as we speak to produce 240 houses a week out of the factory. We can easily double that to probably 500 houses a week within the next 3 months. So as and when the opportunity arises, we're ready to come back to you and say, listen, if there's an opportunity, we will step forward and take the risk on our side. And as I know that you are most also involved with other portions of government, if there's ever a need to use this type of thing, whether it be in education, whether it be in health, whether it be in the police services, etc., you know, there's an application beyond this house. Thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it, and I hope this has been of some value to you.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. And next to me, the Honorable Mashaba is very excited.
Yes.
He's very, very excited to think that we can then now house millions of our people. And of course, the point that you was raising is that as you move on, sometimes it's very difficult for us to follow in terms of the price. That a 40 square meter one, under normal circumstances, who knows, but what is it that we are providing as affordable alternative way of building it? Homes or houses. I think the point that he was just making here. And hopeful again on this one, I think a lot of very nice innovations and technology. I guess that some of them anyway would be far better, I mean, when we see them. And then just to see them really, because Joe is much more excited with this. I was just warning him that let us go and see it first. And then if you see it, and then in the mass production, what can happen, what are the issues. But I think we're just raising the issue of the price, really, that it's important to take members through that. And of course, if it's not a classified information, if it's a classified information, of course, we wouldn't want to do so. Okay, thank you very much for this presentation. I think it's very, very useful for a house, a six-bedroom house, Joe. In 12 weeks. That's very exciting. But the point that Ossie was raising, quietly, Joe was raising the issue that what would you do to change the mindset of South Africans? Because generally speaking, we are brick and mortar. Anything that is not built in bricks and mortar is not a real thing. Even people who have visited all old European cities in America, the Woody, there, but generally the brick and mortar type of psychosis, you know, that whatever we do must be a brick and mortar. It seems we are introducing a new way of doing things. You are just raising this matter because just to change the mindset of people to know that there are other very creative ways of building affordable houses. Outside the brick and mortar approach, because I think the brick and mortar were married to it, of course, we have been doing that for many years, I guess. But the mindset has not shifted on this brick and mortar. In fact, whatever you build, if it is not brick and mortar, in the minds of our general population, is that no, that is a temporary structure. It's just a transit camp, and it's not really a house. Very few of them who can even call a house. General, I'm not sure what is the problem.
then I think the Department of Human Settlement got more responsibility just to change the mindset. I can even see Dlamini here. He has never believed that there is any other thing that can build a permanent house except brick and mortar. Despite the cracks in his house anyway. Despite all the cracks in his house, but he thinks brick and mortar these things to provide a proper house. Okay, members, I think this is a presentation that is very useful. I think you have represented the point that you are raising.
Yes, of course.
And I must be fair to represent you, otherwise you will remove me here. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. You've raised very pertinent questions, and the important one for me was similarly, what is Group 5 doing to change a mindset? Because it's generally accepted in the commercial world. But I think in terms of low-cost housing, because looking at your pictures, you'll see that the low-cost housing, which is generally to the up to, the say, 40 square meter house, tends to look like panels, where your other house, which was 80 square meters, looked more like a conventional house, even though panels were used. And I think that's one of the drawbacks. If you have these, whether they're 600 or 1200 millimeters wide, it comes across as panels. And therefore, people, I think particularly if you tend to get it for free, they don't want it. If they have to pay, then you tend to look at cost. And you say, well, that is cheaper, so therefore I will go for that. So really the question is what is Group 5 doing to, in the housing market, change the mindset of people? Then I'm pretty, I obviously have no doubt about the superiority of the product and everything else that goes along with it. But just as a side question, in terms of the building at the airport, for example, with the steel structure and the panels, it's generally the weight is a lot less than your conventional structure, so there'd be a saving on the foundation as well. And I think with the houses, you almost do a floor rather than foundations as such. But just as a side question, on a bigger structure like that, it looked like you had something which came close to a conventional type of, I don't see the foundation, but there must be a foundation because you then have the brickwork above that, and then your floor, and then the structure. And then you answered one of my questions in your presentation, and that was the finishes. You indicated that the finishing, when you say 7 weeks, for example, for a building, that included the finishing and not just the structure. So you're talking about the finished product. Yeah. Just the one last question, Chair. I'm interested in the 1,500 units in the Eastern Cape. Are they, because you emphasized that most of your units in the low-cost market was tech for temporary structures. Now, you mentioned 1,500 units, and at some point you mentioned emergency housing. I'm not sure if the 1,500 is for emergency housing. I need you to confirm that. And then I want to know when have you started on this, because when we were there recently, there was actually no mention made of this project. So I'm quite keen to get, and perhaps even if you get it, you know, at the later stage, Chair, but more information on that particular project of 1,500 houses in the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Floor.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. It actually sounds like a Cinderella story to me. May I just say that I've also known that Big Five has built quite a number of work at the airport. Safe to say that they're going to experience a lot of shortages in aeroplanes. Perhaps they could help us to build some aeroplanes. But on a serious note, Chair, a big yes, if and when your concern is also addressed in terms of the pricing factor. But I also would like to have a response on the durability against earthquakes. I would like the comment on that.
Honourable Bomber.
Thank you. I think our minds are all going along the same direction. But I think we are at a point where in human settlement we are going to have to be seriously looking at alternative technologies. And our minister has already indicated, and quality is really of extreme importance to us. We've seen some of the most shoddy work when we've been out there. And just to go back, I think it would be good to give us a comparison on a 40 square meter house, the cost of that, and not just in square meters, but, you know, so that we can compare that with what we are building. I also have a question on the foundation, but sort of sees this lightweight framework panels taking off, you know, in storms and that. That was one thing. Then I want to also ask, because these are factory made, does it make a difference to the cost whether you are doing, because obviously the bigger the number, the cheaper the unit. Now, if you are doing smaller developments, does that mean that the same cost would apply because it's factory made, or does that change? And then I think the panel thing has been raised, the look of that. And then we go back to looking like the old prefabricated story, which, you know, is very cheap. And then just one last thing. And you touched on one gentleman who was building a nice little contracting business here, but in this particular portfolio department, we have the potential to create an enormous amount of jobs on the ground. Now, just from listening to you, it seems to me as if bringing all the alternate technology in would actually reduce the potential for the jobs. There might be some that would benefit. And then related to that is the skills transfer, you know, to if you're coming into an informal settlement where people have never had any training, they've had nothing, what is the skills transfer? I know, having worked with Group 5 on the engineering stuff in Durban on the road, you're very good when it comes to that. But how would that apply in the housing segment? Because you'd go in and you'd move out pretty quickly at the pace at which you are delivering that.
Okay. The Director General?
It's a small issue, Chair. I just wanted to check the emphasis seems to be on it from a durability point of view, that it's 50 years. Now, you'll know that in particular, black people, houses form part of their cultural upbringing. Why do you put so much emphasis on 50 years, if any? So the question is mainly then run up around the issue of cost, speed, durability with quality. So I think it's linked into that. Thanks.
Thank you. Group 5.
Thank you for those questions. I'll answer as best as I can remember. Let's start with the concern around the what is Group 5 doing to make people more receptive to alternative technology. I think we are acutely aware of the 5 years that we've been doing this that we cannot change mindsets quickly. That's not going to change on its own. We are not out here to go and take over the market and have every house that's applicable using alternative technologies. I think we as a company would be very, very pleased that if not us alone, but as a whole country, that if 5% of the houses were built in alternative technologies in 2 years' time, that would be a great future. We have a very realistic view of what the natural progress will be. And mindsets change when people experience the difference. That's the only thing that can happen. We can convince people that these houses are cheaper, and I will tell you right off the bat, these houses, depending on how you finish them or how you build them, these houses will be anything between 8 and 20% cheaper than a conventional house. And that goes to answer the one question as to if you have to mass produce large developments, yes, then you obviously get a lot cheaper as time goes on. So the houses are absolutely cheaper. They get built a lot quicker. Once you've experienced the house, and I do this presentation often at our offices in Woodmead. I do the presentation, I immediately take people into the show house in Woodmead. And instantly, you get a sense that this is a real house, okay? Because similarly to this environment, unfortunately, I don't have a show house outside in the parking lot to show you, but should you move out of the presentation into the show house, you would instantly get the feel. And this is it's exposure over time that will come through. Now, we are also realists. We understand that you can go build a beautiful or a perfectly suitable temporary show house that will have panel technology. And if people say, well, listen, I've got the option of the brick-and-mortar house on my left or panel technology
brick house on my right, everybody will choose the brick and mortar house. There's absolutely no doubt about it. So what we do have, and I was remiss in the photograph, but we do have, as much as you saw the 80 square meter house with the plastered finish, the 40 square meter panel house will have exactly the same finish. Okay, so there will be no signs of seams or panels anywhere. So the 40 square meter house will have the look and feel of any other 40 square meter house, other than the fact that it will actually be extremely smooth, it will be very square. All the quality issues that we've got used to over the years, in terms of nothing being straight and nothing being square, will be resolved instantly with the technology, and then an entire house will be plastered. So that is one aspect. So it's a matter of exposure. Also, what we do realize is that often you have to offer a little bit more. If I go to the example of the 80 square meter house, or the 88 square meter house that I showed you, let me just remind you. This one over here. When we build this house, this acts as a show house. The person who buys into this development will have the opportunity of building either a brick and mortar house or a house like that. And we make it a very simple decision. Should you want this house, you'll get an 88 square meter house with these high finishes. Should you want to build a brick and mortar house for the same amount of money, you will then have to downgrade to a 78 or 80 square meter house with lower finishes. So what we will do as group 5 is for the same amount of money, we can either choose to reduce the cost or up the spec level. And perhaps that's a way of slowly migrating people into accepting our different technologies, because we also do realize that, you know, perhaps a 40 square meter house could be upgraded to a 44 square meter house. Perhaps the 40 square meter house could be upgraded to include floor tiles or some sort of other specification that may be suitable to the area. These are all considerations that we do have. These are ultimately decisions that you will have to make as a portfolio committee, because we also do understand that if you take one set of houses and you upscale them, that it may cause a problem in another area as well. So we are aware of those situations. We are prepared to put high specifications in place. We are prepared to put slightly bigger houses in place to prove the benefit of the technology. Or, if necessary, we can also take the price down somewhat from what the standard would be for a 40 square meter house. So those are permutations that we are willing to discuss with you as a committee as well. So in terms of, I'm just trying to remember the question, the panel technology, the houses will be plastered. The more you build, the cheaper it gets, absolutely, because there are economies of scale at the factory. To answer the questions around employment, it is true to say that you do need less people on the site to build equivalent house. This house is built with 12 people. Our temporary houses are built with 5 people. But in the same breath, you know, the opportunity to employ, I'll give you an example. In the Eastern Cape now, we are, not in the Eastern Cape now, we haven't started incidentally that 1500 unit project. We only got the order last week. But in places like Orlando West, Mamelodi, Saulsville, all the other projects that we've done, bear in mind that we've built almost 3,000 of these houses already. What we tend to do is employ a lot of people, it just builds a lot more for the people that we employ. So the truth in the matter is that we will employ less people on the construction site, which will then be replaced by people employed in the manufacturing environment. And what we have committed to the various departments is that where the sites are, we will put up a factory, or where the demand is. So when the demand comes up in, for instance, East London, we will put a factory up in East London, so that the local community within East London will get the employment opportunities at the factory level and the site level. But it's an issue of delivery as well. If you have the opportunity to only build 100,000 houses this year, you may well have the opportunity to build 300,000 or 400,000 houses using a similar type of technology. And those are the trade-offs that we're going to have to make over here in terms of the employment requirement, which will remain there, although it will be at a low level, versus the output requirement as well. Just in terms of one of the other questions, in terms of earthquake, these houses are rated to handle an earthquake of 7 on the Richter scale. As a country, we've never had that. We've never had an earthquake of 7 on the Richter scale, and we are currently quoting to supply houses into Chile. Now, you know that Chile just had that earthquake of 8.8 a few months ago. We are quoting to tender for these houses in Chile. So as is, without any additional modification, we can build a house resistant to earthquake of 7. Should we choose to go higher, we can go higher. There is also a practical point at which it becomes far too expensive to protect against that.
in our country, it never needs to be necessary. But you answer question 7 on the rest of the government. One of the other questions that came up was around the foundation of UMTASA. You're quite right in your observation that the UMTASA structure there had what looked very familiar as a strip foundation. I will tell you that that strip foundation is more of a facade than anything else. The floor is independently held up. And the only reason why we have a strip foundation over there is because when we realized that the structure, which was originally going to be built on pylons, when we identified that the structure was likely to remain for an extended period of time, in order to avoid water erosion underneath the building, we simply put a brick facade around the foundation. And to answer another question, the structure is normally between 1/3 or 1/4 the weight of a normal structure, and it's been thoroughly tested to handle the winds. Again, when we built the first 500 houses in the Eastern Cape, those were built in very, very high storm areas. When we were building in the Eastern Cape, we had one storm where 3 permanent houses were blown over and our temporary houses remained in place. And up until that point, there was mass resistance towards moving into the temporary houses. The very next morning, all those houses were occupied because they stood whilst the permanent houses blew over. So there's a number of different parameters that we have dealt with. I can only say to you that it's not our intention to take over the world tomorrow. We're very realistic about that. You know, as and when these opportunities arrive, we will arrive. I thoroughly agree with the comment. If the intention is to build over 2 million houses in the next few years, there's no alternative but to consider this. And the proof will be in the pudding. The first development will go up, and there'll be interest. And then another 2 will go up, and there'll be interest. And then another 4 will go up, and there'll be interest. And that's the way it's going to spread. And we will make it interesting for those people to move into those houses because they'll usually be slightly bigger or slightly better.
Okay, Nokaya and Labude.
I'm sorry, the 50-year question. Why do I talk about 50 years? It's not a number that I'm thinking out of my stuff. I would ask you to think about yourself. Do you know how long a normal house is guaranteed for? How long is your house at home guaranteed for?
100 years.
The question between how long is your house guaranteed for versus how long will it practically stay? Okay. And the answer is simple. Your house, the longest life product in your house is possibly the brick. If you go to the brick manufacturer today, the brick manufacturers only guarantee their product for 40 years. Okay. And then the list of fine print is about this long as well. And then, invariably those guarantees don't mean anything. We've chosen 50 years for the simple fact that the steel is guaranteed by Mittal for 50 years. Okay? And that's why we've used fiber cement as a guarantee of 10 years. Practically speaking, it'll last 50 years very comfortably. This house needs to be maintained like any other house does. It needs to be painted. It needs to be worked on every now and again as any other house needs to be worked on. So I mentioned 50 years not to say that at 51 years it's going to fall to pieces. I'm mentioning 50 years because at that point the warranties in the steel run out, whereas in your own house your tile will be warranted for 10 years, your brick will be warranted for 40 years, your wood will be warranted for 7 years. You know, so the practicalities of it is that this house will last as long as any other brick and mortar house, and all you need to do is go on your travel to the United States where they build these houses out of wood, and I'm sure the questions would have been far more interesting. This was
a
wood-based
technology.
Maybe you've partly covered me on the 50 years question. You have reset your houses as cheaper, quicker. Then what about the value after some years, maybe after 20 years? Since the durability is mentioned that it's 50 years, as compared to brick and mortar houses whereby the value goes up each and every year. So I'm worried about the value of this house. Are the values going up each and every year or down each and every year?
Thank you, sir.
The presenter tried to convince me otherwise, but I'm not really convinced when it comes to, if you can go to the slide on the Eastern Cape slide. I'm not really convinced that this structure can survive the storms and floods, because we have seen most bridges being swept away by floods. They are built with these big columns. But if you check this structure, you put it on top of some few bricks, it doesn't have a foundation. So I'm not really convinced. And until it's tested. Yes. Thank you.
And so you shouldn't be convinced. I think the purpose of this house is to be a temporary house. This house in reality will be up for about 3 years before this person's permanent house will be rebuilt. The specifications for a temporary house are different to the specifications of a permanent house. I will reiterate that. In actual fact, if you go to a permanent housing or a housing document with the NHBRC or the SABS, you will find no specifications for a temporary house. In actual fact, a temporary house is built completely without specification. I'm not for 1 minute alluding that this house will provide flood or massive storms that will destroy plenty of other houses. All I'm saying is, in terms of the real resistance of this house versus in a storm environment compared to a brick and mortar house, we found it to be remarkably sturdy. We have had a house blown over. Absolutely, we've had a house blown over. That I will tell you up front. And that was blown over because it got caught in the whirlwind. But I will also tell you that house that blew over was not too far from the shopping centre, and the entire shopping centre blew over. So that was brick and mortar. So in real terms, our houses perform very similarly to a brick and mortar house will. Yes, you're absolutely right. It is built on brick. It is secured to the ground, however. Within that foundation that you see over there, there is steel that's been dug into the ground that holds the house down. But in real terms, it's not indestructible, but it will perform at similar levels to an equivalent brick and mortar house.
Thank you, Chair. I just want a clarity. Where the project you're going to start in Eastern Cape, do we have a show house where we can see, and where is it in the Eastern Cape? Thank you.
Thank you. I have 500 show houses in the Eastern Cape in terms of the previous project. I've got a number of show houses in Johannesburg. The show house that was erected, it was erected and dismantled on the same day because that was what it was intended to do. And that was at the Department of Human Settlements building in September. When was it? King William's Town. Was it King William's Town? East London. Sorry, East London. So should you require a show house, I'll be happy to deliver a show house tomorrow and put it up before lunch.
Sorry, where in East London? Because I just want to know where about, then I can visit it.
The show house has been dismantled. As I said, it was erected and dismantled in one day. Should you require to see a show house, I'd be very, very happy to put up one for you all. Minutely. We can take any one of the number of sites in East London or in and around Eastern Cape.
So you don't have any show house in Cape Town?
No, not at that time.
No. Can you do one in my backyard? Without pay.
But it would be disabled.
So could I possibly make mention that it's a very interesting point that you raised, because of the houses we built, all our projects have been for government.
Mm.
And it's remarkable how many inquiries we get on a personal level of people who walk past the houses. And as you saw in some of our sites over there, we do have our signboards over there. We get a number of inquiries from people who want to buy houses privately based on what they've seen.
Well, it does avoid that time anyway, is not on our side. But we should move on and try to get more. I know that also we want to buy these houses as individuals. For rural areas like Mpumalanga, KZN, and Ekala, somewhere. I think we'll be somewhere in Msunduzi at Taban, and you can buy all these houses there. Ted.
Breaking down, but I just wanted to make a point in terms of the mindset of the people, that one of the things that we would request the committee to do for us, firstly, is to allow us to come here. It's not an easy thing for us. We take it with regard to the very serious opportunity to come here. Secondly, is to, because we are not politicians, easy for us say things to you in this meeting which we feel can help you. And that's the mandate from Group 5 that we have. That we have to help the department in terms of delivery of houses, not just to build them, but also to talk about issues of changing of mindset. In 1994, I was the first provincial housing board of KwaZulu-Natal. We were talking about a house in a stand. We said people are not going to like houses that are together because they haven't had houses before. I think now, after 16 years, we also have to take the lead in terms of saying to the people, we have tried brick and mortar. We can't afford brick and mortar anymore because of the speed. And in some areas, we don't have water. In South Eastern Cape, there's no water. We don't need water for building this kind of structure. And the opportunity that we would also like from you is to say to us, here are sites where we want you to put your show houses so that people can see them and thereby change the mind of people in that sense. So I'm saying those things that together we can do it. But we need the acceptance and the assistance from your side as well. We are there. We are prepared to do whatever we agree on here to do with you so that we can take the process forward. So we will be able then to change the mindset of the people. I wrote in another article also about the cutoff date for free houses because I'm not a politician, so it's easy for me to say that. And I said, we've been doing this for 15 years. Should we continue with free? Or should we start looking at alternatives for the people that we are giving for free? And maybe put a date where we are going to say after this date we finish the list, and after this date this is how we're going to do it. That's what we're doing. But also there was also the $1 billion guarantee fund that was announced by the minister, which means that if the banks are serious, there will be a lot of demand. We as Group 5 are prepared to do the supply side of the demand that you will have with your $1 billion guarantee fund. So that's why I'm saying we take this opportunity very, very seriously. Thank you very much.
You wanted to make a follow-up? We are right.
I just wanted to make a follow-up on the question about the value. Can we regard these houses as investments?
Yes, absolutely you can. In the history of where we've got to now with the banks had a very similar concern when this first started, because the banks were saying at one stage when houses were being repossessed, at what value could they resell those houses on if they were built in an alternative building technology? So that concern was raised by the banks quite a few years ago. And what's happened is that we don't have tens or hundreds of thousands of houses as examples of this, but of the houses that we do have, we have noticed that those houses are following the exact same trends of the market, because the houses look and feel exactly as a normal house. You are limited to a smaller clientele for the simple fact that there are less people who are going to be prepared to accept it. But in terms of actual evaluations of those houses and how the banks see them, the banks are prepared to 100% bond these houses because they know that they will have the same value as any other house, and their house value is a part of the same thing.
Thank you, Chair. My next question relates very much to the discussion just before the value of the houses were discussed. And that is, Look, there's definitely an opportunity for us. And, I mean, the shortage of material, cement, etc. And not only that, but also in the rural areas we've come across, you know, where they say that it is difficult to, in fact, get material close to a building site. But having said that, doesn't surely Group 5 does, when a tender goes out, whether it's from a province or a metro or whatever, for a development, for affordable low-cost housing, surely that you participate in their tender? Which then, my next question then is, what are the reasons, and from a cost point of view, and certainly a durability point of view, you've got the advantage. Why then, in your mind, do you not get those tenders? So that we do see more of this type of housing out there, and as you indicated, I think once people start living in them, they it will cause a mind change. But why aren't you then performing more within this market? Why don't we see you out there delivering as part of the whole tender and delivery process?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, sir. I mean, just in relation to Member Stan's point, I think one of the sort of drawbacks in the tender process is the detailing of specification. So, like in any tender, you can manipulate your specification to end up with the product that you have. And one of the issues that we're going to have to deal with as the industry, and particularly the department, is when you put out tenders, do you spec it for? So the current process is that tenders are spec'd for brick and mortar. The issue is that we've got to change the ability to put out not only for the Group 5 technology, but I think for alternative technology. That's the first, and I suppose it's the issue around the question of acceptability. So the fault lies, you know, not the fault, but I think there's an issue that we need to change the way that we spec our tenders based on what the overall requirement is.
My job, I want that to close.
Yeah. But you know, this discussion makes me wonder. Actually, we've just been talking here informally with my colleague here and saying, although we don't necessarily like, you know, temporary housing, but wouldn't it help if, for instance, you also try to change the mindset of the working and the thinking and the policies of the department? I'm just wondering, for instance, if it wouldn't be better for us, for instance, to solve the problem of the mushrooming informal settlements rather by putting up these buildings temporarily as they may be. But at least, you know, they are certainly better than what we see in the informal settlements, and they can make the lives of the people better. Is it not possible for you also, maybe with our help if you think so, to change, you know, the mindset of the department itself, to say, let's say, for instance, an informal settlement in Cape Town gets burnt down, the whole place, we see that very, very often. Now, instead of them saying to the people there, or rather allowing the people there to rebuild these things, because they usually do it almost immediately, instead of allowing them to rebuild these things, we say Group 5 technology should be applied here. Then in that way, we improve. We don't only replace, you know, the accommodation, but we also improve the accommodation in an informal settlement. Thank you, Chair President.
Jawood?
Thanks, Chair President. I still have a problem with this temporary structure. The presenter said it can survive 3 years. Where exactly did you put that temporary structure so that we can see it physically? Then that will take us forward.
Okay, let me answer the question probably in reverse order.
Sorry, let me answer the question in reverse order then. We at Everite have been putting up temporary houses probably for well over 10 years. In actual fact, the very first temporary houses that we built on Cape Town,
and they are completely different technology to what you see over here. But the fact, the fundamental fact is that they contain fiber cement, and those houses are still standing today. Dan, 14, 15 years ago?
Yeah, in Delft, the houses... Sorry, Chair. In Delft, the houses are standing for the last 14, 15 years, and some of them have been plastered externally. And then 4 to 5 years ago, the 5,500 temporary units that were used to rehouse some of the Joe Slover incumbents are also made out of a similar technology, but certainly this technology has been upgraded.
So yeah, we have a number of different houses which have been around for a long time. The houses in the Eastern Cape have been around for a year. The show house that I showed you earlier has been around for 4 years. Mama Lodi, Saltville, Soweto, these ones have all been around for 2.5 years and still standing, still looking strong. There's very little difference between this technology and what you'd experience in Australia and the United States. We're not the first people in the world to do this, certainly not. We don't pretend to be the owners of this technology. We just pretend to be good at what we do, and that's what we're saying. In terms of lifespan, we've got plenty of examples to show you from a lifespan point of view. Just going back to one of the other comments, which I agree with you, in terms of the opportunity to go into an area and help change the mindset of both the department and of the people, it's exactly what we're trying to do, and this is why we appreciate the opportunity here to speak to you. We've been trying a bottom-up approach. We've been speaking to many of the departments, the project managers, that type of thing, and to have an opportunity to speak from the top down helps us as well, which is exactly what we need today. If there's an opportunity to take over the site, yes, we will do so. If there's a rectification site like in Orlando West, yes, we will do so. To answer one of the previous questions, why have we not been successful on these tenders? It's very simply because we have not put the alternative building technology into the tenders. Group 5 has been building thousands of low-cost houses over the last couple of years, all in brick and mortar. The reason why we haven't gone to the alternative building technology is because we've been dealing with the commercial and industrial environment, with the residential housing environment, and with the government temporary environment. This is the first time that we've put forward a 40 square meter unit, but it's only now, in the last 2 or 3 months, that we felt comfortable that we've got a product that we can put our name behind. So, in reality, we haven't tended on any products, and in a sense, perhaps this presentation would be somewhat premature. It might be better in a year's time if we said, well, look, we have 1,000 houses to be built. But the comment around the tender specifications is very valid as well. There are very few projects which allow the flexibility of putting alternative technology in. And again, this will take quite some time. It will take years before we get into a mass rolling program, and we accept that. But what we ask for is the opportunity to start small and grow into the role.
And we have one in the
book. Sure. Okay, call it. Thank you very much. I think thank you for the presentation. And. From time to time, the committee will engage whoever is interested to present some new ideas and then see how things move and what we want to do, and I think the department is there to deal with all other matters. And no higher standard. If you want one house there, I think you can get one. You buy one and then it becomes your show house in standard. Thank you very much, Group 5. I think it's very important information. I think there are issues and challenges that we have to work on. Hopefully, the department has engaged stakeholders from time to time. They'll also address the mindset of office. So as long as we have a large number of people who simply reject anything that is not brick and mortar, then it will take time for us to address some of the problems. I think the minister was saying, in fact, the backlog is so huge. And they will take us how many years? Must 70 years, something like that. Just to do the backlog, Honorable Tandaban to Mashova. And then Tandaban to Mashova. And therefore, we've got more challenges on some of the issues that we are raising. And then hopefully, we'll be able to run them and work on them.
and see the Eastern Cape and other areas. I think as we do our oversight function, I think we may visit some of the areas. Honorable Mashoba, can see how things are moving on this matter. Okay, colleagues, I think we let us agree that Kufat has made his presentation of first question. Like all presentation, really, there's a continuous engagement, also on their side, a continuous improvement. And then what they can deliver in 2 days' time, I think 10 years from now, it would be 1 day's time. Mm-hmm. And then what they can disassemble within 2 hours would be 1 hour. That'd be a very nice job, because we're a migrant anyway. Every time you move to Joburg, you take your house with you and put it somewhere. Disassemble again, go back home, and I think that would be a nice thing to do. Thank you very much, colleagues. I think it's a nice discussion.
Thank you.
Maybe we can work on it. We should continue, comrades, colleagues, and the department is going to be briefing us on faculty. Babuzu. And that's what we want you to assist us on. I think there are a lot of matters that were raised about the faculty. And I know that on our side also, colleagues, they've been raising the issue, which I think the department, one way or another, is dealing with this matter of reselling of the RCP houses. Yeah, but specifically selling of our government subsidized houses to non-South Africans. Because it seems there's a bigger problem. I think all of you colleagues who have read some of the papers, I think there's a lot of research on this matter. That also there's likelihood for another xenophobic feeling. I think one of the matter that is causing that, we are told, is the number of South Africans who are selling their houses to non-South Africans. It seems a bigger problem, and we think that we need some policy approach on this matter. I think a lot of experiences in other countries, anyway, that you don't sell your house, even if you are a South African or European, to a non-South African person. But it seems much more popular now, the Pakistanis, the Somalis, the Ethiopians, it seems they're buying a lot of houses. It seems they're causing a lot of resentment, because those people, once they've sold their houses, they also try to find ways of getting back their houses, but not paying people back. I think it's a bigger problem. I think that research was saying that the likelihood again for these problems is likely to happen sooner. And then I hope for all other structures that are doing these matters on their toes, trying to address them. Tagli dates and is a bigger issue in many other areas that people have not been giving tagli dates. And as a result of that, today sometimes they are not thinking these houses belong to them. They will have a rear from the department is presenting to us. I think we should then allow the presentation by the department. Babu Zulu, when else is that?
Thanks, Chair, for the background that you have just provided with your opening remarks. I think the context is very critical. I tried to get into the original context of the issue myself, because at times we officials, we get more carried away about bureaucratic processes than getting into the critical issues of concern from members who represent their constituency. So that's why I was trying to get a sense of, are we being generic in our approach, or are we going to be more solution-oriented to problems that we have just highlighted. So the context that you have just provided, it does assist moving forward to deal with the issues. However, Chair, maybe for the benefit of the committee, we look into the normal process for the committee to have a better sense of how the process of issuing titles takes place. We'll then deal with the key role players, because in the process that the role players that are also involved, we'll also deal with them. We'll also look at the general challenges, some of which you have just referred to. But for me, most importantly,
is also to reflect what measures we need to put in place, which is the point you've made, in dealing with the issue of casualties to our people. So I'll ask our chief operating officer. I must also indicate to the committee, without being apologetic, the chief operating officer and I are only 3 weeks old. We are beginning to familiarize and contextualize our responsibilities, but nevertheless, we have decided to hit the ground running and take the responsibility that the government has given us. So bear with us, should we have some gaps here and there, we will be in the next 2 months up and effectively running to make sure that we serve this community with the respect and the dignity that it deserves in terms of response. Thank you, Chair. So I'll hand over to my COO to do the presentation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, members. As the DG has indicated, and what we've done is that we've prepared the presentation, and there's a substantial amount of background, but it also attempts to sorry, Chair, I'm just trying to get rid of the screen. Thanks, Chair. So, I mean, the presentation will focus on the issues as indicated, and there have been copies of the presentation handed out, I hope, to all the members. And I know there is a time constraint, so I'll go through it, and if I do go through it too quickly and I don't touch on the issues, please, I'll sort of take members through that where I'm pointed to that. Just in relation to the background, the registration of ownership and handover of title deed to a beneficiary of the subsidy in the state's housing program is the ultimate and is probably the last step in the entire housing process. But just in relation to these points here, the title deed represents one of the more important things in the sense that it's the ultimate issue around security of tenure. And it addresses the historical legacy around the question, and it's one of the fundamental issues post-94 in terms of security of tenure. That's the first issue. The second issue is that it also represents, in many respects, a value in terms of the investment, because one of the issues around the title deed is that if you want to mortgage your house, if you want to be able to get some asset. And as we've indicated, as part of the government's process, we want to be able to build individual citizens' asset bases. You need the title deed. And in many respects, if we sit around this room, if you don't have the title deed, it's one of the major issues that needs. So those are just the two issues in relation to that. And I think the last point that's quite important here. Once a title deed has been registered, it cannot be reversed without a court order. And it's a fundamental individual right in relation to that. So sometimes one gets concerned about the flippant and the manner in which individual citizens manage those title deeds, because abuse of title deeds is a big issue, and we'll pick that up. The legislative mandate, the key issues here around is the Deed Registry Act, the Development Facilitation Act, and the Less Formal Township Act, because those two last acts allow for the Deed Registry to register your title. The legislative mandate, I won't go through this, I think members are probably aware of this. Security of tenure, and I think it's as I've indicated, it's the basis and one of the fundamental issues about our historical legacy that we're trying to address. Because it confirms citizens' rights, it confirms your citizenship, it confirms your very essence of a South African in terms of your home and your household. The township establishment process, and I we've included this
Chair, so that, you know, when people raise this, and I suppose in future when we're interacting, just for the information of the township establishment process, sometimes, and the committee would have gone to a whole range of projects, you know, the township process lives long after a house has been built and occupied, and sometimes it hasn't been completed, and that's why we have some of these responses around that. And it's one of the issues that we've raised to say and consider for consideration in relation to how do we shorten some of these processes, or how do we sort of streamline these processes. So ultimately, when the house gets constructed and a family moves into that house, that there can be a simultaneous handover of the title deed. You've got situations in the country where 2 or 3 years after a family's moved in, they still haven't received the title deed as a result of some of those bureaucratic processes. The deed registry's office, and I think we've just given an indication of where these offices are in South Africa, and they're quite sort of important in the scheme of things of property and housing. We've just given the deed offices and the areas of jurisdiction. The key role players in relation to this is your local municipality, the provincial government, the developer and the surveyor general, your beneficiary, and your conveyancer. And that allows for just an indication of how that would operate. The process followed for houses constructed after 1994, and just gives you an indication. So when the committee does go out on oversight, these are some of the processes that are documented. So in your interactions with municipalities and provinces and the department, this gives an indication of what happens at what stage. And you'll see it's a pretty legal, formalistic, administrative process. And getting people to move that chain is the big issue. The processes after that, one of the big issues, as we this presentation has been consulted with a number of the provincial departments and local authorities. One of the concerns that have been raised is the second last bullet point, call-in letters sent out to beneficiaries to collect title deeds. Now, in the process of the transfer of ownership in terms of the pre-94 townships, that's specifically within the African Indian Khaled and to a certain extent the former white areas, there's a substantial number of title deeds that have not been collected that are sitting at municipal offices, and municipalities and provinces are speaking about the inability to be able to get people to come and collect that. And it's one of the issues that we try and say that we need to raise, or how do we address some of those issues? But I think what we need to be understanding about is that there are processes and mechanisms that have been instituted to get people, but how do you, other than going out to get people to come in and collect, because the title deed cannot just be handed to anyone. I mean, there's a strict formal process where an ID document must be presented, there must be a signature, so it's quite a rigorous process, and it's not one that can just be willy-nilly applied, especially when handing out that title deed. The deed process conducted quarterly on there's a deed monitoring process conducted quarterly by the National Department, where we check and extract. We compare the National Housing Subsidy Database, housing subsidies, and it's also one of the processes that we use, which allows us to ensure that people don't double dip into the subsidy or in relation to the houses. The issue is that if the deed registry is not up to date, you might have situations where people double dip, but that's largely been eradicated from the process. The Department of Human Settlements beneficiary match against the deed data. I mean, I think members will be aware that there's a full 13-digit ID search, and then the first 10 also ID search that matches that. So there's two processes in relation to that. Title deeds matched to a state subsidy at the end of 2010 is 1.74 million title deeds that have been matched. So you'll see that there's this. So the title deeds transferred is in effect, this slide represents the number of title deeds that have been registered since 1994. As I've indicated, this is one of the initiatives that's utilized by the municipalities to accelerate acquisition of title deeds. This is an example in Swane. And as I've indicated, what we're quite sort of satisfactory about is that the municipalities, together with the provinces, have got quite a strict process in place. So title deeds don't get handed over to non-beneficiaries, and there's quite a strict process in relation to that. Challenges that slow down or hinder the title deed registration, project implementation. I mean, the process is heavily administrative, as I've indicated. There's a number of land ownership issues that are not resolved. There's general plan approvals. One of the issues, Chair, is that it's quite a detailed process of matching. So once you've got a general plan, you've got to match that general plan with a specific ALF. You've got to match and ensure that there's no mistake. So it's quite a laborious process in relation to that. So mistakes, you know, at a high level, might be forgivable, but at an individual level, when you have a situation where Neville Cheney's ALF is incorrectly recorded in a general plan, results in an incorrect deed. So what we're aware of is that within the administrative process and within the sister departments, specifically the deeds office, they pay a substantial amount of attention to ensuring accuracy. And I think the one thing that we can state as a country is that you don't have those number of mistakes or incorrect deeds registration. I'm not saying there aren't, but it's not a major issue. I mean, our problem is where houses get sold without deeds or titles or those kind of things, but mistakes against the deed office is one of the other issues that's not listed here is that specifically in your older pre-94 African or designated areas as they were, you'll find that general plans didn't exist. So you've got to go back and you've got to do an entire general plan, recreate your entire township layout, general plan. A classic example which I can share with the committee was for those of us that are familiar, Kwatema. The Kwatema Civic Center, as we sit now, was not proclaimed. It's still sitting on agricultural land. So you've got filling stations, you've got the civic center there, but we inherited this lack of a general plan in that. I've just given Potema, but it's in many of the areas. So what that does is that you can't issue a title deed until you've done all that. And some of that cleanup work is still taking place. And what we're suggesting in the proposed measures is instituting processes so that we can fast track that, because the wealth of the country is built, in essence, on the title deed property system, because of the value of those things. As I've indicated, mix-up in sites occupied by approved beneficiaries, illegal occupation of demarcated sites in townships. Township establishment, as we've indicated, and this is one of the issues by which we said the land use management bill becomes quite important, is that you've got the less formal townships act and the DSA to speed up the process of township. But there's a whole range of administrative processes that still don't address that. So we're hoping with the land use management board, and that's within the framework of this committee, to perhaps maybe sort of push the other departments to get that LUM promulgated and enacted. As I've indicated, although there's some pre-94 issues, but there's also some post-1994 issues. I mean, Ashesville Extension 17. 1997, the land was bought by the council from ISCO. The design of the township was completed and submitted, and then therein the problem comes. A portion included in the design was land owned by the province. The result was the township ownership was not consolidated, which is a requirement. Now, whether this is administrative or whether it's competent in terms of the professionals, in this case, when we asked what the problem was. So you'll see that the net result of that failure is 700 houses have been built and occupied, but there's no township registered to register the title deed. So we're sitting with that impasse. So until that township's consolidated, but the question gets asked is why was it and why is it taking so long? So, and it's a monitoring mechanism that we ask and need to be put in place. Some of the processes where the title deed has been registered and is ready for issuing, you find that upon allocation, your approved beneficiary can't be found. I mean, it's a common issue. If found and allocated upon registration of title, the beneficiary or the family may have sold or rented the house or is deceased. Then there's the occupation audit, illegal occupation. Title deed also cannot be handed over to occupant of the site as a result of informal change. So all these informal, I mean, one of the concerns that we need to address and mechanisms we need to put into place is changing people's mindset about how important it is, because you can't just informally sell a house because there's a whole range of consequences. There has been sort of allegations or points that fingers pointed at the deed registry's office. When you go to the deed registry's office, they will indicate to you that there's no backlog and there's potentially a 6 week. But there are processes, and I think the issue is the communication and the discussion and the ability for us to be able to improve our accuracy. So in relation to the people we appoint and the people we project manage, that if your documentation is clear, accurate, your registration goes. I mean, I'm sure all of us sitting in this room have at some period in the last couple of years had a house bought or purchased or transferred, and it hasn't taken that long. And it points to a lack of accuracy and administrative sort of ability. We've listed for the committee's attention one of the things here, or the points that have been raised by the provinces. What we can't accept in relation to some of these issues is that there's a fee that gets paid for, and what we can't do is incentivize people perversely. You know, if project managers are brought on board, we can't be incentivizing them further other than what they get paid to do work for. And you'll see in the proposed measures, we're not suggesting that. Because you're getting paid for it. There was a consequence in relation to delinking sites from top structures, and this has created some challenges as well. So I mean, I hope, Chair, what we've done is that we've provided a quite an intensive challenges. So that the committee is aware of some of these things and may have raised them, but what we've indicated. I mean, issues here, difficulty in tracing of title holders during visits to houses, other pieces, persons are in occupation, household substitute the original approved beneficiary. So in between the period when the house gets constructed, you have people change over, you know, family move out. Unresolved deceased estate issues should be deceased. And the one point which is raised previously, beneficiary apathy in responding to calls for title. The proposed measures that we're suggesting, and I think this is something that can be expanded upon, but it's an issue that we want to put some of these issues on the table, specifically with the provinces and the municipalities. One is the development of a coordination and early warning mechanism with the deeds office on the registration of title deeds, and that would include your IT linkages and your information technology exchanges. The point is that to allow the deeds office to expect influxes and to allow for us, because that's what the private sector does. You know, if there's an intended increase in the number of deed registrations which they require, they normally sort of sit down at the deeds office and say to the deeds office, we've got this number, there's 2,000 coming, can we assist you? And that's a very simple mechanism of actually engaging with the other, and in many respects that doesn't happen. Regular and consistent community awareness and communication campaigns related to title deeds. And I think it's at the political and policy level around this issue is the continual reinforcement. And one of the concerns is that we've raised the issue of people picking up, but I think what we haven't emphasized is the importance of the title deed, just in relation to that. But I think our communities are aware of the importance. In relation to the pre-94, some of the provinces have ring-fenced a dedicated allocation to appoint project management teams to assist in the resolving of the legal and planning blockages. Because I think one of the issues is that we need to sort of clear up the backlog in terms of the administration and procedural backlog. A measure that's been instituted in some of the provinces, particularly in the Western Cape and KZN, was the introduction of a retention amount within the subsidy pending title deed registration. So what that does is that your project manager has to ensure that within a specific period after occupation, there's a title deed that gets handed to the municipality to be handed to the beneficiary. And then two sort of perhaps maybe radical and ones that we need to sort of look at is the investigation of a mechanism of linking local government service provision to the submission of annual proof of a title deed where it's been handed over. So we get people to understand the importance in relation to that, so what this does is, Chair, is that perhaps it'll go some way to preventing illegal occupation, illegal informal house selling, because what that means is the person buying the house informally will not be able to access local government services. It might be a harsh, and I think you would take guidance from the committee and politically on this, but there needs to be that kind of incentive and sense of order. And then the one that is in process is the investigation in the long term of alternative methods of titling, which promotes security of tenure and discourages informality and is less legally cumbersome. What we need to be able to do is investigate a methodology, and in this regard, we can come back to the committee on a regular basis, because this is a matter which we need to, and particularly, for example, families who have acquired subsidized state housing in areas where it's community owned, and there's permissions to occupy. How does one deal with that aspect? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much for presentation. Any addition from the team? Yes, ma'am.
Chair, I think I must say that we may have to report back to the portfolio committee, maybe in one of the meetings, with regard to the PCC, special PCC that has taken place, because this was one area which was highlighted as a challenge in the area of human settlement. But I think it will be also correct for us as a department, maybe in your next meeting, to give you a full brief on what has transpired and moving forward, what measures are going to be taken, because it's in line with what you are doing. The issue of title deeds was also one of the issues, but we've been given a task to deal with this matter as an internal matter that does not necessarily require the attention of the PCC because of the processes that are only governed by government. I think the diagnosis that is being presented, for me, is still not sharp enough to reflect on the critical measures systematically within our system that should be put in place, especially from an IT perspective as well. What systems are we using? Are they conducive for the massive work that we're doing in human settlement? So the diagnosis is good, but it does not, for me, give a better sense of what actually practically we can propose it must be done to deal with the matter. So I think for me there's still a challenge on that, which I think the department will have to work on very effectively. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and I think it's a very important intervention. Just hope that members then will bear in mind that they have to do other things before you are sitting at two. Honorable Mashishi and Dave. And Bula. What is the experience, Bula?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to applaud what the department has done on this matter of title, because it was a very big crisis in our provinces. So I'm supporting the proposal that they have made. And then I also like to just to ask the department that they must do follow up on what the proposal that they've made. As the DG promised that we then report back, please just do like that. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is, in fact, for me, a classic example of what we spoke about earlier with the Commission, where on paper the things appear to be, there's a process and it should run very well, but on the ground it doesn't. And I'll tell you why I'm saying this. I was called last week while I was in Limpopo by somebody in Jansenville, where a question was put to me that they are busy building houses there. And apparently it is the beneficiaries are some people that may, in fact, they've been allocated sites, and they may have some sort of a temporary building on the site, and the actual house is now being built. But in fact, whoever's doing it there, in some cases, they are building a house for Richard on my site. Now, Richard is going to come live on a property that belongs to me. And there is clearly, I mean, he will never have title to that property because the house is being built on my earth. And I'll be very glad to pass on information to the department so they can investigate that. Then I'd like to know who facilitates the township registration, which department, and the I'm not sure if it was the DG or if it was the chief executive officer that actually said that the committee should try and help, because it goes probably over a number of departments. But who actually facilitates this? Then, once again, the process is clear on paper, but I know for a fact, and I've experienced it, that there are, in some instances, councillors that are, in fact, handing out title deeds. And yet we are being told that there's a very strict process followed by municipalities. People have to identify themselves, etc. But in reality, in some cases, it's not happening. There's councillors going out there with a bunch of title deeds, and they're handing them out. I made a note here about when I saw all the challenges and I questioned the solutions. I'm glad to see that some solutions are being proposed. But I want to take up the DG on his offer that they can come back at some point, because it doesn't go far enough and in detail. You know, it's one thing to say put mechanisms in place, but I think we need to know what those mechanisms are, what results they're going to achieve. And the other question I've got in terms of the 70 rand, or it's soon going to be 70 rand per registration, who pays that? Who's responsible for that? I don't believe that's in the subsidy. So if it's the municipality, I'm just wondering if it's not a demotivation for some municipalities, both in terms of providing housing, and then secondly for the backlog of the registration, because they simply don't have the funds. Then a last question, Chair. The 1.75 million title deeds has been matched. It says clearly it has been matched to the presumably approved subsidies. That doesn't necessarily mean, first of all, I want to know, does that mean that they've actually been given out, or is there some of these that may be with the municipalities? And secondly, it doesn't necessarily mean that the house has been built, because it can be registered purely when the site has been allocated, I would imagine. A subsidy approved and a site allocated. Thank you, Chair.
On our Bula, and Oman will follow, and the taller.
Now, thank you, Chairperson. I think that Honorable Steyn had covered most of the issues that I wanted to deal with. But apart from the issue of councillors being involved in the, it also creates an area for corruption. And I had the opportunity to do some oversight work, and quite to the fact that, houses are sold before the beneficiaries move into those homes. The allocated beneficiaries. Now, these are some of the challenges, but on a much positive note, we appreciate that the DG has given us some sense of hope that these kind of irregularities and mismanagement will be dealt with. In view of what is on paper, I also want to support the sentiments expressed. It seems all very good. But when you go down onto the field, it's quite a different picture. But we understand that there are challenges, and we've heard the presenter allude to the fact that the issue of the Land Use Management Bill plays a very important role. So it points at us harping on issues where there are weaknesses and grey areas. We need to put things in perspective. And as soon as we do so, we will be in a position to deal with all the irregularities. But I was overwhelmed when the presenter touched on the issue of pre-1994. I'll tell you why, Chairperson. I had the opportunity last week to meet with some of the communities. And let me tell you, it's a havoc situation on the ground, quite contrary to what has been presented. People are waiting for over 5 to 6 years for title deeds. But there is a very, very negative factor in terms of the subsidies. I think currently in the pre-1994, they've been utilizing the enhanced extended discount benefit scheme. people are asked to sign memorandums who have huge areas, and these are the negative factors that prevent the processes of title deeds. Now, I think this debt relief policy that we have been speaking about needs to be implemented. We need to kick this in order for us to ultimately achieve what you're correctly pointing out here, which is unachievable. You're never going to achieve it if you don't address the core challenges that prevent you to deal with the administration. I find it strange, a pensioner who owns a huge area cannot obtain her transfer, his or her transfer, which is a total contradiction to what we are saying in terms of the Act. Now, how do we deal with these challenges? Because if we say we're going to allow the pensioner to continue to owe this, then you're not going to get that pensioner to get the title deed. There's just discrepancies between municipalities. For example, a municipality in the rural area by the name of Amdoni Municipality, in comparison to Itigweni Municipality. Now, Itigweni Municipality has this approach where they register a debt, and that they continue with the transfer, but the debt is registered on the deed, which is quite contrary to other municipalities. So I think it's an issue of policy directors, and it needs to be thoroughly investigated. And yes, it gives us the chance also to come in here and say to you, these are the challenges on the ground, and you are never going to achieve your ultimate goal unless you don't start putting your ducks in a row and stop putting the cart before the horse. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Buddha. Foreman.
Right, I think it just remains for me to ask the question. The title deeds that are sitting in municipal offices, that's really a worrying thing. Can you just give us some idea of the extent of that problem? And again, I think we're getting back to the question. I can't understand how you can be sitting with that and you can't actually get the beneficiary to collect that. You've got to know the address. You know, you've got everything. I can't understand. So if we could just have some idea of the extent of the problem, I think that could be helpful. But then again, you know, that needs to be followed up on. Why are we not doing anything about it? We know that that's the problem. Why aren't we going in there and doing something? Thanks.
Manjo.
Yeah, Chairperson, I'm not asking a question, but just to a comment. I think some of the problems that we get, like people not collecting the type of business that they, or like people selling their houses illegally, or like people occupying houses that don't belong to them, and so on and so forth. It seems to me what we need to strengthen is what is said here on this one pager, bullet number 2, regular and consistent community awareness and communication campaigns related to title deeds. I think we need that, and it must be taken seriously. Because this is some of the, it's quite a good number of the beneficiaries of the houses that we are talking about. Are people who have probably grown up in rural areas and they had never bothered about title deeds, you see. And now they are in a situation where they have to own title deeds. Maybe they are not taking it seriously enough. As long as my house is there, I've been allocated a house, finished and done. But the responsibilities that go along with the occupation of that house may not be clear to the people. And therefore, I think, in my opinion, we really need to have an educational program to make our people understand their responsibilities too, you see, towards, for instance, the housing process that we are talking about here. And I would then say, Chairperson, maybe when the department comes to report next time, they can actually tell us what awareness programs they actually have so that we too can assist them, you know, in enabling the people to understand. But the awareness program has got to come from the department, and then we can support that.
Thank you very much, Tola. You wanted to make a point?
Same. That is a maiden. Maiden point that is made.
With a
clause.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I have a concern about the issues of privacy. Because what I want to find out is the house has been occupied by legally occupants. What happened to the privacy? I'm talking from the experience because in Kashiong there is some people who are living in illegal in houses. And in Togos. So what happened to those privacy? And the offices, I want to know how many offices per province do we have? Let's say have a mandate to issue
that. Thank you. Okay, Chief, we can take the floor.
Thanks, Chair. I'll address them. I think, Chair, I don't want the committee to be under the impression that we're saying everything's rosy. And I don't think we're saying that. I think what we're saying is that there's systemic administrative procedural issues in relation to this, which needs to be addressed, and it's a long process which we've inherited. I mean, if we take the fact that we've had 2.8 million subsidies approved, matching those things. So in relation to it, I mean, I'll just go through some of the questions. I mean, in relation to we've matched, but we've matched against the subsidy. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's been handed out, and in some instances that's related to service sites. So that figure we'll have to come back to the committee based on the question that's been. The 70 rand registration fee that comes out of the subsidy, and it's another sort of drain on the subsidy because that's a collective cost that's part of the subsidy. I mean the points around the question of councillors handing out title deeds. And walk in. I mean that's been an issue. The question is that we'll investigate it, and if it's there, I mean it's not something that's supposed to be happening here. So we'll take those points. I mean, the township registration or the township proclamation process is one that's managed by the Deeds Office and the Surveyor General's Office, which sits with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. So the designated sort of responsible ministry or department is Rural Development and Land Reform. And as we've indicated, Chair, I think what we need to be able to do is, as the DG has indicated, you know, a lot of these things are internal issues which we need to resolve, and hence the reason we can't pass the buck, because continually people have been saying the Deeds Office is a common cause of concern. But as we've indicated here, and that's why we've said, we come in here and we come in with open and clean hands to say, these are the issues. And if you look at these issues, they're either procedurally in terms of the people we manage, in terms of project managers, so the accountability issue. Two, it's either the provinces or the municipalities, and that monitoring mechanism, we need to improve that. And thirdly, it's about individual bad behavior and misdemeanors that compound that, and how do we address that or apply certain sanctions against them. But I think what I want to reiterate is we don't want the committee to feel that we're saying that everything's fine there, but I think we also need to be fair to ourselves as a collective, that it's not exactly chaotic. Our titling process we've inherited is a British model, and it's probably one of the most cumbersome ones that is there. And it's our ability to be able to administer that. And that is one of the issues that we need to. So, you know, post 94, we've had this huge drive. Question is, administratively, have we been able to do that? And that's the question that that we'll probably have to come back. Thanks, Chair. I don't know if the DG wants to add on.
Okay.
Chair, I can only say that I think our proposals and measures will have to deal with the system. It's a systems issue. And I think I support the idea which was emphasized at the PCC that let us come with proposals that deal with systems. And we have different players who play a bit of it. So if any process gets delayed, either by municipality or the Rural Development Ministry or ourselves, it affects the whole process. And then, for as long as we have a system that is not efficient in dealing with the problem, we then create a room for corruption. Because people understand the system, then they know how to corrupt the system. So for me, we need to come with systems approaches that will even say, is it a good idea to have so many key role players dealing with this piece and the other dealing with this piece? Why don't you have at least two or three or one, for that matter, that will deal with the entire process up to its finality? Then we are able to deal with challenges within that, or even to cap corrupt practices. I mean, it's an irregular, for example, to have councillors issuing title deeds. I mean, that's an official responsibility. But you'll find that within the system, there are problems that at the end of the day, some officials prefer councillors to go and hand over those title deeds because they don't want to face communities. Now, that creates an anomaly. I think we need to do a diagnostic assessment of the systems that deals with this. Cut where we need to cut, apply a competency-based model, and say, this is what will work better for us. And I think the CEO is correct. We have inherited systems in the past. We have not changed them to suit our new conditions and our environment. And we try to adapt them, and we don't come with new things that will be easily adopted and understood, even by our constituencies that we serve at the end of the day. So that realignment for me is critical, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is so short. When you check the deeds registration offices, there's not even a single one from Mpumalanga and Limpopo. I don't know whether maybe they must drive to Johannesburg or Pretoria. There are two provinces which does not appear here. Mpumalanga is not here. Limpopo is not here. I'm sure that there are no people who are living there, maybe. I don't know. Thanks.
They must go to London to apply. Chief, wanted to respond?
Confirmation that there are no offices.
There are no offices.
Yes.
Oh, okay. No, I thought that the Director General Joe has raised an issue. That even in the structure that the president was attending and addressing, they've raised some of this. Because everyone is very worried with the slowness of in terms of giving people targeting. Given the fact that the reason why the current government gave people these RTP houses and not houses was also to ensure that we address the question of asset poverty. And I'm not sure how it was. He wanted people to be able to go to their banks and say, I do have this, and can you borrow me 200 rand because I want to engage in a business. It seems the main issue works. It defeats the main purpose. Because the main purpose was to address a critical point, among others, poverty. Asset poverty. And it seems if you are not moving with a certain speed, you won't be assisting people to get involved in economic activities. I think that will defeat then the main purpose why you wanted people to have this RPP and other houses that are given to them. I think that the department that is responsible in this coordinated department or sector department must really address this matter. I think at the director general's level, there should be a thorough discussion. Because I think the backlog is going to be increasing. And then if the backlog is increasing, a large number of people are almost out of the economic activities in our country. It is a large number of people anyway, because we have delivered a lot of houses. Stan, I think we agree now that there are 2 million houses on the ground.
Subsidies.
Okay. I thought that are 2 million houses. Now it's subsidies. Okay, fine.
2.8 million subsidies approved.
Yeah.
And that's on record. I've got it on record now.
Okay. No, that's fine. But I think we must address this thing, Director General, and I hope that as you come back to our meeting, you really, once you are ready, you can take us through also on the very same issue. And then I think the Mpumalanga and the Mpombo and on the Joe could be addressed. I think the department will address these matters as we move on. But it seems there are too many departments involved, and I think it's going to take a long time, because it's bureaucrats by its very nature, and one department is very difficult. Just one department is very, very difficult. Four departments and local authorities, I think it's worse. It's just worse, and I think it's a very bad way of doing things. Hopefully, that's a problem again, that we inherited a lot of good and bad things, I guess. But I've never really sat down and said, what is it that is working in terms of the state that you want to build? And ensuring that we really speed up the process of giving people what state I think belongs to them. Thank you very much for the presentation. Also, thanks for coming. And I think it's a very nice presentation. Just again to remind the Director General, and I think that's what I said, my colleagues, or maybe some, that we always appeal that the documentation that is presented to us must be given to us at least 7 days before the meeting. Because that assists us not to use our brainwaves in the meeting. So very easy, everyone, brainwave, there's no substance that will produce. Because we get things here, must read, at the same time must think and apply our mind. I think that's very difficult. I think the administration got more resources than any other member of parliament. Therefore, they should be able to give us information on time. When we come to this meeting, we can then engage and then assist you to address some of the problems as you observe them and also on the ground. I think that's what we can do. And then I think then Babu Zulu will assist us to do that. And the team will always do that because we are together until 2014. And then these faces that are here, they're here permanently, unless the organization decides to redeploy Bradshaw because of age. And therefore, that can happen. And then thank you very much for the presentation. And I think we'll have a very good working relationship with the new Director General. We had a very good working relationship with the acting Director General, Honorable Sabantu. And then we had a Duke General working with COVID, Koswana. In general, really, we've been working very well with the department. But I think there's room for improvement in terms of coordination of things. That we are giving information on time in order for us to read and come here well prepared to engage you, because it would be a really waste of time. You leave Swane, you come here, I think it's a lot of money. When we are here, members are just read this thing here, we can't engage you in a meaningful way. And it becomes a very difficult thing. I don't think the bureaucrats in South Africa want members of parliament to be stooges. Because there's no value. If members of parliament become your stooges, there's no value at all. Because you are paying them anyway to do their work. They can't do their work if information not given to them accurate on time. The information that is correct, that will assist them to address the real challenges of our people. And the point that I was raising earlier, that there will always be healthy tension that we can't avoid, but we must allow that to happen. Because the only way that it can assist us or propel us to higher levels of performance and higher levels of development. I'm just very happy because the president himself was, I think, is taking real interest in the human settlement area. And then I think, therefore, we are much more privileged because we can raise issues completely with the head of state. Sometimes you meet with the head of state. I think we are most privileged people. Therefore, we can be able to move this thing and make sure that things happen on time. Okay, I think members, thank you very much for it, and thank you very much for you. I know that we have an hour to enjoy yourself before the sitting that is going to be very long. It's just, I think we should try to do things this way. I think members, Honorable Tandabantu, Zwabantu, or Mtuabantu, Mashova. I think we should try to invite one agency per meeting. and then with other stuff, because it just assists us to be thorough in our discussion. And sometimes I think we invite a lot of people at the one meeting. Sometimes really, it is very expensive moving from Gauteng to here. And you go back with members who have not really interrogated things correct. I think it's very expensive. That's what we should try to do. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned until further notice. Babu Tole Siyabo.
What